You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
All of them, all of them. We're constantly thinking about the West and what the West does in Europe, 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 Europe. That was the big thing. The important, you know, direction was westward. The people around Putin think very differently. They see the South, they see the East, including Siberia, and they even see the North, the Arctic Circle, which they think is extremely important. So they want to turn, shift Russia away towards another civilizational model, and they also believe that the Russian values should be different from the ones that the West advocates. So it's a desire for a uniqueness, of fully fostering a distinct, separate Russian civilizational realm.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Andrei Rajewski, who blogs as The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. The Saker was born in a military family of white Russian refugees in Western Europe, where he lived most of his life. After completing two college degrees in the United States, he returned to Europe, where he worked as a military analyst until he lost his career due to his vocal opposition to the Western-sponsored wars in Chechnya, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. After retraining as a software engineer, he returned to the United States, where he now lives with his family. He has been blogging since 2007 as The Saker, and his analytical essays are now widely distributed on the Internet. He is the author of The Essential Saker, From the Trenches of the Emerging Multipolar World. Today we discuss the uniqueness of Russia, both its historical differences and similarities with the West, 300 years of Western domination, the Soviet period, the wars in Chechnya, Russian military defenses, and Atlantic integration versus Eurasian sovereignty. Saker, welcome to the show again.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
In your article, Searching for Russia, you write that Russia is different in a profound and unique way. Being an heir to the Eastern Roman Empire, also known as Byzantium, Russian roots are in antiquity as opposed to the West, whose roots, according to you, are in the Middle Ages. Could you explain this history?
Well, we're talking about a long chunk of, we're talking about practically a millennium and more even, but I'll try to make it simple and short. Basically, first of all, Rome and the Western civilization and the consciousness, we're taught that Rome was sacked in 410 AD and the Western Roman Empire 476. And after that, begin the Middle Ages. Well, for Russia, that sequence doesn't work at all, because what happened is that the Roman Empire was separated in two parts, an Eastern and a Western one. And in the West, we're told that there's a Byzantine Empire. But if you look closer at it, there was never such thing as a Byzantine Empire. There was simply a Roman Empire that continued to exist, the very same Roman Empire, not a different entity, continued to exist in the East and existed until the fall of the Constantinople in 1453. In other words, the first thing to realize is that the Roman Empire did not end in the 5th century. It survived by a full 1,000 years. So while Europe was undergoing the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, Rome continued to exist. And that Rome played a crucial role in Russian history and culture, because it is really what I would say the arrival of Roman Christianity is what created the Russian nation. There were different, I don't mean that in an ethnical sense, I mean that in a cultural sense. At the end of the 10th century, a Russian ruler named Vladimir accepted to become a Christian. He became an Orthodox Christian, an Eastern Christian. And Rome basically infused Russia with its, at least, religious tradition. And that that tradition was passed on to Russia. And if we call Rome antiquity, because there never were any Middle Ages, properly speaking, in Russia, there was also no Renaissance, which is, if you want, the emergence from the Middle Ages. So what we have is a country that was founded by the infusion of Roman civilization into it, that never had any Middle Ages or a Renaissance, and that went basically from antiquity, you could argue, straight into modernity. The fact that the process, which was so strong and important for the Western history, which is the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, simply never happened in Russia. And to strengthen that also differentiation, another thing happened is that to the degree that the Roman civilization played a key role in the founding of Russia as a culture, the founding of Russia as a state is also due to a process which the West didn't know, which is the invasion coming from the east of the Tatar-Mongol Empire, who occupied Russia and who stayed there for 250 years. And basically, that is what united different Russian princes into one state. And I would say that the Russian state, in terms of its polity, military tactics, etc., was a product of the Tatar-Mongol Empire. So we have Roman origins spiritually and Tatar-Mongol origins in a political sense. That's dramatically different from what the history of the Western Europeans was during the same time period. So while Russians are externally, they look European because they're mostly white, you know, they don't have a different skin color. I would argue that they're extremely different culturally.
That's very interesting. I was just about to ask you how significant was the Asian Tatar-Mongol invaders in the creation of the modern Russian state. And I guess you're saying that it was quite significant.
It was extremely significant. First of all, the ancient Russia lost about half of its population. It was a very brutal period for Russia. And the original cities of ancient Russia, for instance, the best known is Kiev, suffered tremendously. And new cities appeared that were capable of resisting that. They learned from their occupiers and then eventually kicked them out. And the Tatars forced upon the Russian nation forced the political model upon that nation to make it possible for that nation to resist and eventually prevail, which is what happened.
You write that the brand of Christianity received by Russia was the Roman, not the Frankish one. What
Correct.
Is the difference? What's the Frankish one?
This is what in the West would be called Roman Catholicism or Western Christianity or Latin Christianity. And this is a key to understand why there were so many wars between, I shouldn't say wars between Russia and the West, but I should say why there were so many attempts by the West to subdue and conquer Russia, is that Russia practically from its foundation was in opposition to the West in terms of its values, civilizational outlook, ethos. I mean, Russians never were truly part of the Western culture. Now, I know some people are going to be shocked when I say that because they're going to say, what are you talking about? What about Tchaikovsky? What about Dostoevsky? What about, you know, so many, how should I put it, representatives of the Russian culture that played such a big role and were very much influenced by the West? If you look at the architecture of St. Petersburg, the penetration of Masonic ideas in the Russian aristocracy, that is all true. There was a profound I don't know if you can say that in English, interpenetration between the West and Russia. But that interpenetration affected primarily the elites, the aristocracy, the courts. So it was, this was a reality at the top, not at all at the bulk of the Russian nation. The 90% of the Russians were not involved in that process at all. So that also creates an interesting dynamic, an alienation and a profound alienation of the masses versus their elites. It took a dramatic turn during the 17th century on an internal Orthodox dispute where I don't want to go into complicated dogmatic issues here, but I would just say that the people had one outlook on Orthodoxy and most of the elite another one, although I'm simplifying that. Some of the elites, you know, were on the other side, etc. There was basically, I would say, a schism, a chasm breaking open and gradually getting bigger and bigger and bigger between the rulers of Russia, starting with particularly Peter I, the early 18th, late 17th century, up to the revolution. So there was tensions vertically in Russia and tensions east versus west.
You have started to explain this, but how have the Russian ruling elites differed from the Russian people, particularly in the last 300 years?
Well, a couple of things happened at the same time. Peter I wanted to change the face of Russia, as he would have put it, and his supporters do, to modernize it and open it to the West. I would simply say westernized. Why not use that term? A lot of the old elites were at that moment moved away. The old aristocracy, for instance, the old nobility was moved away from the centers of power. He created a much more recent new aristocracy and ruling class. At the same time, he introduced a number of reforms which profoundly alienated the people in their culture and their religious feelings and the way the society should work. I mean, things which can look funny, you know, when we speak nowadays, for instance, having beards. For Orthodox Christians, it's very important for men to have a beard because this is how it's, you know, you're supposed to uphold the image and likeness and image to God, that the way you were created. Well, Peter the Great said it's a barbaric thing, that wisdom is not in a beard but in the brain, and he forced a lot of people to shave their beards. For the Russians of that period, that was very traumatic and very insulting. So it manifested itself in that kind of things. Secondly, of course, there's the fact that, how would you call that in English? Suddenly I have a word that's missing me. I missed a word here. Krepostnoye pravo, and it means serfdom. Serfdom, there we go. Serfdom was also something that profoundly alienated many Russian people. So there were event after event after event which gradually broke more and more the masses from the elites. And I would add something paradoxical here. A lot of czars perceived that and wanted to defend and had that sensitivity to try to, I would say, represent or cater to or be concerned for what the masses wanted. And that created yet another problem, the opposition between the monarchs and the aristocrats, which is very much overlooked in Western historiography. There's always an assumption that there's the monarch and the court and the aristocracy, and they're all together. You know, it's absolutely not true. In Russian history, monarchs were typically, the principle of aristocracy and monarchy were opposed to each other, and a lot of monarchs were killed because of that. So yet again, this schism in Russian culture and the Russian nation created yet another tension now among the elites. So it's a multi-layered cake of contradictions which exploded eventually truly dramatically in the 20th century.
What was the point you were making about serfdom alienating the masses?
Well, for instance, serfdom basically was, generally feudalism was an import from the West. Russians are, and have been in history, very freedom-loving, and bordering on the anarchist tendencies were very strong. You know, self-determination, autonomy, local rule, self-rule. There were very, very numerous examples of self-rule by cities or by group of people. That's, for instance, how the Cossacks had it. The famous Cossacks were very highly autonomous in their culture and very jealous of that freedom. So when the center tried to impose feudalism and serfdom upon the Russian people, a lot of Russians fled. They fled to the borderlands where it was safer and you were further away from the central powers. Other went to Siberia. The same thing when I mentioned that schism inside the Orthodox Church. To make it very simple, there was an old rite and a new rite. I'm not going to go into details of what separated the two. A lot of the old ritualists actually emigrated from Russia. They went from all sorts of countries. Some went to Turkey, some went eventually even to the United States, and even South America still has nowadays different groups who fled that authoritarian central power in Russia.
I'm speaking with author and analyst, The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that there is no way to consider the Soviet period as a continuation of the pre-1917 Russia. Do you consider the Russian revolutions of 1917 as a complete break with historical Russia?
Yes, but I have to say, first of all, there are two revolutions in 1917. There's a first break in February of 1917. There was a coup organized by the elites against the Tsar. And then in October or November, by the old calendar, there's yet another revolution where the Bolsheviks seize power from the Democrats. So the Bolsheviks, contrary to what mostly people think, never overthrew the Tsar. They overthrew the Masonic government of a gentleman named Kerensky, who was representing typically what we today would call the oligarchy or the globalist, you know, oligarchs. That's what they were, really. Very wealthy, rich people. Remember I told you that the elites after Peter had a different agenda than the Tsars, and that was typical. So the first oligarchy overthrew the Tsar, and then the Bolsheviks overthrew the oligarchs. And yes, it is a break, though it has certain common features with traditional Russia. It's impossible to completely say that there's no continuity. After all, it's the same cities, the same language, the people were involved. But on a philosophical level, I would compare that difference. The image that I always use is a healthy tissue versus a malignant tumor. A tumor shares a lot of the DNA with the tissue that it came from, yet it has crucial differences, and these crucial differences are sufficient in many cases to actually kill the host that is suffering from that condition. And that's what communism and the Soviet period was for Russia. It was an anti-Russia, but with a certain degree of commonality on the DNA, definitely. For instance, the values of community, of collectivism, of fairness. I mean, all these ideas are very much rooted in Russian culture. So the communists were not stupid, and they didn't come up with only things that would shock Russians. They said, you know, we'll give the land back to the people, back freedom, abolish inequalities. All these things speak profoundly to the Russian culture, but it comes in an atheist mold, for instance. The virulent atheism of the Bolsheviks was something that profoundly shocked Russia, which traditionally was a very religious and pious society. Secondly, a lot of the early generation of Bolsheviks were ethnic Jews. And careful here, there's also a mistake that people make. The fact that a majority of Bolsheviks were Jews, does that mean the majority of Jews were Bolsheviks? A majority of pre-revolutionary Russian Jews were not Bolsheviks. They were usually socialists, Mensheviks, and Bundists, and all sorts of different parties. But it is true, and even Putin recently confirmed that, speaking in front of a group of Orthodox rabbis in Moscow, he said about 80 to 85% of the first-generation Bolsheviks were Jews. And that's factually true. And these people were extremely Russophobic. They hated the Russian culture, which they saw as anti-Semitic. They hated Christianity. And Orthodoxy was a very traditional form of Christianity. So even though most of traditionally anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews was something that you saw more often in what is today the Ukraine, which is southern Western Russia, when the Bolsheviks seized power, they truly opened a persecution. I would say that I think there was an attempt to really truly commit a cultural genocide of Russia by these people. So when you have that happening, you can't say that this is just a continuity of the same old regime under a new heading or wrapping.
Do you believe that the 1917 revolution, that is the second one, the communist revolution, was not inherently Russian but imported from the West?
Oh, yeah, there's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, Trotsky was an agent of the United States. Lenin had contacts with the Germans. It was definitely an import. What happened was that basically once the oligarch or the liberals or the Democrats, if you want to call them, took power, the country went into such a degree of chaos that I would compare that to somebody which has a severe immune deficiency. And it wasn't that hard to infect it with something. And the most organized, I would say the intellectually superior group, actually, were definitely the Bolsheviks. If you look at the writings of Lenin or Trotsky, these guys are smart. They had a vision. They had a plan. They had a global explanation of what's happening in history. When I compare them to the infinite mediocrity of the non-entities who took power early that year, the Democrats, it's no surprise that they lost power, you know, 8 months after seizing it. They were just good enough to destroy the empire. That's all they could do. They couldn't build or fix anything.
You write that, quote, in a cultural and spiritual sense, the Russian nation was oppressed to various degrees roughly between 1666 and 1999. That is 330 years, a long period by any standards. How would you characterize this oppression?
I would say, first of all, you shouldn't take those dates, you know, as a instant binary switch from non-oppression to oppression and then back again. So it's just rough dates. I chose them because they were symbolic of two events. One is the Council of the Russian Orthodox Church in 1666 and 1667, which I think played a catastrophic role in the history of the Russian Orthodox Church. And 1999 is the coming to power of Putin. So that's where I took those two figures. That oppression was basically that throughout these years, a different civilizational model was imposed upon the Russian people. It was the Western aristocratic model. Then it was the Western oligarchic model. Then I call it Western, the Western Bolshevik Marxist model. And then at the last end, we had again a return to the rule of the oligarchs during the Yeltsin years. During all those years, the top of the car, I would say there were moments where, of course, it fluctuates. Some were much more patriotic than others, much more respectful than others of Russian culture. And some rulers were profoundly, you know, not interested in the Russian culture or hated it even. So it's not uniform. I would say that probably for the first time, most Russians felt that the person in power in Russia represented them and not some kind of elite above them. I would say it's probably Vladimir Putin.
You write that for the first time in centuries, the ruler of the Kremlin is not somebody whom the West can hope to subdue or co-opt. Hence the hysterical paranoia about Putin and his evil Ruskies. Are you amazed at the histrionics in the press and by everyone else about Russia and Putin?
No, actually, I'm not. I mean, I'm amazed that they actually do it, but somewhere I am not, because it makes sense. I mean, you have to realize that look at the history of Western attempts to subdue, invade, occupy, you know, and enslave Russia. A lot of them happened during the years when Russia was weak due to those internal contradictions. I mean, I would say, for instance, Russia had major problems internally during the Napoleonic Wars. Russia had major problems internally during the Crimean War. Russia had fantastic problems during the First World War, which was stopped because of the revolution. But had there not been a revolution, Russia would have won that one also. So what happens is the West truly fears a united Russia. There would be a profound bond linking the people, the masses, and the person in power, which is today is Putin. He embodies that. And this is simply a country that is going to say flat out, no, we are not going to follow your model. And Putin has been outspoken about that. He's the first person that I'm aware of, certainly in the West, that has marked people, that says not only that we disagree on specific tactical issues, we actually reject your civilizational model. Now, there have been others. There have been, for instance, part of the Muslim world, particularly the Iranian Islamic Republic, has rejected the Western model. There is a model in Latin America, you know, 21st century socialism or Chavism and all that movement. There are different movements that challenge the Western cultural supremacy and legitimacy even. But Russia is the one that comes armed with nuclear weapons, the largest country on Earth, the largest reserves of, you know, fossil fuel and all sorts of riches, and makes it very powerful. And the West is frightened because Russia, it is true that Napoleon, his attack ended up with Russians in the center of Paris, and Hitler, you know, essentially brought the Russians to downtown Berlin. So there is a fear, I think, a very profound fear that Russia could eventually strike out and finally, you know, if not attack, that at least crush the empire by refusing to be subdued. And I think that fear is founded. I think this is a founded fear, and I think this is exactly what we're witnessing today. I think the simple fact of existing independently is a mortal threat to the world hegemon.
Has Russia ever lost a war? And could you mention some of the very big wars against Russia? There have been so many, I can't keep them straight.
There's a lot of them. I would say that's the closest thing to a loss of a war, I would say, is the Crimean War. Although even that is complicated, the consequences were pretty rapidly mitigated. I would argue that Russia won against Japan, and I know that most Japanese historians see it that way, but in the West, it's considered that this was a war that Russia lost. Russia can definitely lose battles, and even sometimes wars take a very long time until they prevail. They fought a long time against the Swedes, for instance. So it's not that Russia is necessarily invincible, but I think that Russia is truly inconquerable to begin with due to geography. And secondly, I do think that the Russian culture is so profoundly filled with military ethos and tradition that it really creates a different kind of soldier. It's hard to explain in a couple of words, but the mindset of the Russian soldier is very different from the mindset of the Western soldier. It's a cultural thing. It's collectivism again. It's the willingness to sacrifice your life for the greater good. That's why you see the kind of resistance that you saw, for instance, during World War II in horrible battles that Western military simply never provided.
You've written that every one of those wars was accompanied by a frenzied Russia bashing campaign in the media and literature, and all these wars were represented as being fought in the name of lofty European values against the barbaric hordes, etc.
Sure.
You also say that in the years when Russia was not the object of a military attack, she was always the object of economic sanctions under one pious pretext or another. Now, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because Russia, for instance, well, we can make a short survey, for instance. There was something called the Northern Crusade. It was when the papacy decided to either subdue or forcibly convert or kill all the Orthodox people in the East. At that time, from a traditionalist papist point of view, Orthodox Christians are considered schismatics, rebels against the Holy Father. And that has been an ancient dream of Latin Christianity, to finally, in one way or another, absorb Orthodox Christianity. So that's, you could say, the Western religious vendetta. Then comes the political one. After Freemasonry truly gained power in the UK and in France, Russia was seen as the backward, obscurantist monarchy, Christian monarchy, that was considered a threat to the Western order. So therefore, again, Russia became a target. And a large part of the Russian aristocracy actually even became members of various Masonic lodges. And yet, when the war broke out between Russia and France, those very same Russians actually went and fought and died. So even those westernized, and that's not English, but I will say it, Masonicized Russian aristocracy, they still fought for their country. And if you read War and Peace, you see that there's real patriotism, even amongst those circles. So that was, again, a defeat of the ideology of the day in the West. Then we have, of course, the episode with Hitler, who wanted to create a united Europe, who had the same exact rhetoric as today the Ukrainians, which is, there's those Asian Mongol hordes in the East, and we have to protect Western civilization against those barbarians. And he added on top of that a racial theory which said that Russians were subhumans, Untermensch, and he had this drive to the East to give new lands to the master race. These things that today sound ridiculous for us, but let's be honest, that was the mainstream Western ideology in World War II. There's a reason why Hitler took all of Europe without much of an effort, let's be honest. So that was the order of the day, and again Russia resisted. And now we went to the period after that where democracy, Western capitalism became the big ideology, and Russia was communist. Yet again, you had to defend the free world against the commies, It's always... There's always a very justifiable and ideological explanation, which not only permeates the newspapers, but eventually permeates literature and the general consciousness. I mean, I really think there is an anti-Russian racism in many circles in the West. I've seen it myself many times, particularly people don't know that I myself am Russian. I've heard it. I've seen it. It's there. It's a mixture. And phobia in two senses, of both fear and loathing. It's a combination of both.
I'm speaking with author and analyst, The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You've written that gradually and insidiously, the hatred and fear of Russia became part of the Western cultural identity. And you've already basically been talking about this. Don't you think that this is pathological?
You know, it's hard for me to judge, to speak of a pathology of an entire mix of societies, because the West is not uniform. That I should actually say, that's actually probably a very important point. What I described is mostly Northern European, at least the recent phenomena. The Southern Europe has been very different in its attitude towards Russia. And I also should have probably mentioned the competition between the British Empire and Russia, who was what prevented, in many instances, the British Empire from ruling the way it wanted. So there still is a rabid Russophobia in the English, the British elites nowadays. I would say much stronger than the United States, even. So I don't think it's a pathology. I think it's a consequence of a history where there's no clear natural border. Russians are white. They speak an Indo-European language, which is close to, you know, other Slavic languages and further to the west, like Polish or Serbian or Bulgarian. So on one hand, Russian look, I was speaking as a non-Russian now, I take that hat on. They're kind of like us, but then they're frustratingly not like us. They always end up not doing the right thing. So people get frustrated. And secondly, they judge the Russian people, the Russian culture by purely Western standards. And of course, they get it wrong. It's very interesting for me during the Cold War to observe that the biggest authorities on Russia and the Soviet Union were almost without exception people who profoundly hated Russia and hated the Russian culture. I think of Richard Pipes as a perfect example of that kind of Russophobe. I would stress, by the way, if somebody's interested, that Professor Stephen Cohen is probably right now one of the best specialists on Russia in the United States, and he does not, repeat, not at all display that anti-Russian character that most Russian specialists or Soviet specialists during the Cold War were almost always showing. You know, the Russians were bad guys. You could really tell that. He does not. So I highly recommend him. I respect the man, and whatever he says today is very always worthy to listen to. So yeah, I think there is a global, you know, this has been going on for centuries, roughly a millennium, and that's a lot of conflict, and it ends up, you know, building the image of an enemy. Sadly, but true.
Earlier, you made reference to Western Freemasonry. What would be a simple explanation of Freemasonry?
I think there's an impossibility of simply explaining in a rapidly what Freemasonry is. I would say it is, without going into details, it is a worldview, first and foremost. It used to be an organization, of course, still is. But it is the idea of progress, of civilization, of rational thinking. It's a very specific approach to religion, which I don't want to characterize here. It is the ideas of enlightenment. Basically, it's a mainstream ideology today. The values of the century today right now come straight out of Masonic lodges. But honestly, I cannot give a quick answer. I mean, that would take a full hour to even begin to outline. It's a very complex phenomenon, and it was different in different countries. You know, the French Masonry is not the British, is not the Russian, is not the Italian. They're all very different. It's not the American. So it's a very complex. I cannot, you know, summarize into one, but I would just say that this ideology at its core is profoundly anti-Christian, is profoundly anti-monarchist, and that a lot of Russian, and it's something that's typically an ideology for the elites. At least it was. It was the people who self-identified themselves as being the elites, the thinkers, those who think free, who are free from prejudices and, you know, obscurantist prejudice that usually they would say are in religious circles or monarchist circles.
You've written that Putin's rule is a kind of very traditional Russian neo-monarchy, and that Putin mm-hmm. has found a way to combine the external forms of democracy with the internal characteristics of Russian monarchy. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes. I would make a comparison. It's not a perfect one, but just to illustrate the point, look at modern Japan, or even more Japan during, you know, the 70s probably. You had a country which is a democracy, but really the country is run, the moral authority of the emperor is extremely high. And that is the same thing that's happening today in Russia. For the first time, I would say, if I had to say where the real center of power of Putin is, it is the popular consensus behind him. And he's extremely aware of it, and he caters to it very directly. He reaches out on a regular basis. He's very skillful at that. For instance, it's very interesting. He has very long shows, at least once a year, which is a call-in shows where people call in or write in, and the audience, you know, asks some questions. And the kind of language he uses is a very popular one. He tries. I think he's not misrepresenting himself. He's just presenting himself as somebody that is close to the people, and the people actually believe it this time around. All rulers always try to do that, but I don't think very many were successful, at least not in Russia. So I think it's Solzhenitsyn who said that the spectrum of all powers range from regimes whose authority is based on strength to those whose strength is based on authority. And I would say that the strength of the Putin regime is based on its moral authority with the people, far more than the outcome of an election or let's say, you know, what kind of money he has or doesn't have, or the political party that supposedly is the main party backing him. It's much more complicated than that. And I think that caters to a need Russians identify and like that. Russia is a country that has to be led by a strong person, for sure. But it has to be a person that people feel is on the side of the people and not, you know, trying to cater to the agenda of the wealthy elites.
You write that the Chechen leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, created a personal guard for Vladimir Putin. What is that all about?
It's absolutely true. He did. I mean, it wasn't very much commented, but what he did is he took basically most of the elite's forces. I think there was 10,000 people at that time in a stadium. It's on the internet. You can find that. I have it on my blog somewhere. And he basically, these people resigned their commission altogether officially so as to not be bound by their legal obligations and swore essentially an oath of allegiance to Vladimir Putin as a person, not to the president of Russia. Kadyrov clearly said that. He said, you know, this is a guard that is at the service of Vladimir Putin, and anywhere you tell us to go, whatever orders you tell us to fulfill, we will do it. Buddy, if you can interrupt here, if you want, I can look up that quote and quote him more accurately. Do you want me to find that?
Oh, okay, sure.
Okay, so here is what I'm quoting now, direct translation of the words of the leader of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov. He said, "Today I repeat the words of Ahmad Haji, which is his father, who was murdered by terrorists." And he continues, he says, "It's time to make an informed choice. And we say to the entire world that we're the combat infantry of Vladimir Putin. If we receive an order, we're actually proved that this is so. For 15 years, Putin has been helping our people. Now, you and I, and we have 10,000 of people specially trained, ask the national leader of Russia to consider us a special voluntary unit of the commander-in-chief, ready to defend Russia and the stability of her borders, accomplish a combat mission of any complexity. We realize that our country has regular army, air force, navy, and nuclear forces. However, there are tasks that can be solved only by volunteers, and we will solve them," unquote. So this is absolutely fascinating because a number of things. It came to almost a genocide of Chechens, I would say, during the two wars between Russia and Chechnya, when Chechnya was ruled by Wahhabi extremists. And what happened was a very unique phenomenon in history. Two men decided to trust each other to stop that, Putin and the father of Ramzan Kadyrov, Ahmad Haji Kadyrov. And the Chechen nation, it's amazing. Chechens used to be despised as being, you know, those Wahhabi terrorists, etc. Now they're even fighting in the Donbass, defending, you know, Russian Orthodox people, although they're themselves Muslims, against the Ukrainian Nazi death squads. I mean, that's how much it changed. And Putin is extremely popular in Chechnya, as is the leader of Chechnya. And he basically returned to an old model, which is the model the Cossacks had, the same model, which is basically the central power gives us very large autonomy, that we're responsible for the border and we'll be the shock units defending the country if needed. And that's basically what Chechens nowadays, they play a central role in Russian special forces, for instance, who have fully integrated Chechen special forces inside the Russian ones. We've seen them in Syria. They were before in Lebanon. Chechen volunteers fight in the Donbass. They became sort of the shock troops, I would say, of Russia as a country. And in that case, Putin never accepted it, of course, because he has to be, you know, function within the bounds of law in Russia. But the message was a very powerful one, which means, you know, if somebody tries to, say, organize a revolution in Russia, I'm going to send 10,000 of my men to protect Putin as a person. And if you look at the video on my website, it's subtitled in English, you take a good look at the guys that showed up at that stadium. These are tough, tough, tough soldiers. You don't want to fight them. Chechens, even when Russians hated them during the war against the Wahhabis, never did the Russians say that Chechens are cowards or weak. They're extremely tough. So that is the new function of Chechnya. It is the Chechens have become sort of the policemen of the Caucasus, and they would be at the forefront, for instance, if the Wahhabi insurgency in Syria and Iraq, if it suddenly turned north in the worst case at all, Chechens would be absolutely the forefront of fighting that. They're now, the entire military of the Chechens is sort of an elite force. And because they're Muslims, it's much more intelligent to use them in Muslim countries because there's a brotherhood between Muslims that non-Muslims would not share.
Well, how did the Wahhabis get in control of Chechnya in the first place?
It was, yet again, thanks to the Democrats. Just as the Bolsheviks, seized Russia easily when Kerensky was in power, during the time of Yeltsin, there was such a chaos that people were disgusted with the center. And it's important to remember, Yeltsin had just, organized a bloodbath in Moscow in 1993 against the parliament. He basically did a completely illegal coup. And the West applauded him, of course, enthusiastically for, quote-unquote, restoring democracy. The regime that he put in power was corrupt to an infinite degree, and it was a violent regime. It began by disagreements on the proceeding that the money that would come from gas and oil in Chechnya, and basically the regime around Yeltsin said, we're not going to negotiate with these people, we'll just crush them militarily. What they had forgotten is that it's one thing to shoot at a parliament with tanks in Moscow and quite another to fight a small nation, admittedly, but an extremely tough one. I don't wish anybody to fight against the Chechens. And on top of that, because the locals were so corrupt, the Chechens had inherited a huge amount of weapons from the Soviet military that they took under their control when they declared independence. The city of Grozny was a very heavily built, strong city with several fortified centers at the center of the city where they could fight very well, and the Chechens were motivated. They were not only motivated by Wahhabis, they also didn't want to deal with the kind of regime that was in Moscow. So the Wahhabis, they came in there, they injected themselves there, just as they injected themselves in Syria, for instance, and in other places. They felt that this is a moment, there's a crisis, let's inject ourselves into that, and they gradually seized power by the usual methods of propaganda, corruption, and violence within the Chechen opposition, let's call it this way to not characterize it. And the worse the Russian onslaught began, the more people in Chechnya first went, you know what, these guys are fighting for us. Let's fight on their, we'd rather have them than the Federals. So what happened then is, again, the same thing as in Syria, very similar. Eventually, the Wahhabis began their crazy stuff that they usually do everywhere, which is, slave markets, torture, Sharia law applied in a completely primitive way, terror. I mean, they began to do all the stuff that we see in Syria, and that's when the Chechen population said, no, we don't want that. And that's when the person, Ahmad Haji Kadyrov, and then his son came in, who said, basically, let's stop this war. It has to be stopped. We will get rid of the Wahhabis, which they did. But we also want our Muslim traditions to be fully respected, which they are, and they want not only cultural and economic autonomy, but the center, because Putin did understand how important that was, poured billions of rubles into rebuilding Grozny, which was flattened to the ground completely. Now it's one of the most prosperous cities. It's beautifully been rebuilt. So these two men basically, at the last second, changed the course of history, which could have been horrible.
I'm speaking with author and analyst, The Saker. Today's show, In Search of Russia. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, now the Wahhabi takeover of Chechnya was supported by the U.S. CIA, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, very much. And by the entire West. I mean, at that time, the European Parliament was receiving delegation of course, Chechen, what else? Freedom fighters. They didn't call them good terrorists then. They didn't call them Mujahideen, but they were, freedom fighters and, independentists, etc. The West was completely to the hilt pro-Chechen. Nobody cared about the horrors, the torture, the atrocities committed against Russian people first and then against Chechen people by the Wahhabis. Nobody cared. The West got a little bit disgusted when the first English technicians who were building cell towers in Chechnya began being decapitated, kidnapped, tortured. So when it hit eventually Western expat, there was sort of a little cold that happened. But as long as these guys were butchering the locals, the West was giving them a standing ovation. It's absolutely disgusting.
In your article, The Best Armed Forces on the Planet, you say that Russia is now the most powerful country on the planet because of two things. Russian rejection of the post-World War II U.S. worldwide hegemony and what it represents, and because of Vladimir Putin's rock-solid support of the Russian people. How does the Russian rejection of the U.S. model make Russia powerful?
It makes Russia powerful out of proportion with its her actual power economically or militarily, because it sets a moral, it puts Russia in a position of moral leadership of resistance. If you look, it all began with a speech, I think, in 2007 in Munich by Putin, who, you know, basically told the West bluntly in its face the truth about the hypocrisy of its behavior, contradiction, what we discussed last time between what it's supposed to stand for, what it really stands for. More recently, we had the speech by Putin in the UN where he said, "Do you even understand what you have done?" Speaking about the Middle East. The fact that Russians say that, and for instance, the Chinese never do, even though economically they're infinitely more powerful than the relatively small Russian economy, puts Russia in a unique position, which is the one to be the spokesman, the not the leader in an organizational sense, but objectively, we see it today again in Syria. Russia is the country, the only one that can actually stop the U.S. in its tracks. And the Russians are willing to do that. Now, they're not doing that because, by the way, when I say they're willing to do that, I don't think they have much of an option. Most people realize in Russia that giving in and submitting to the Western demands is essentially turning Russia into Ukraine. They don't want that. They see what's happening with Ukraine across the border. They say, God forbid. They remember the 1990s, and there's just no way they're going to let that happen. So they took a stance, a firm one, already when the West was on the borders of Russia. It didn't happen very early. When it was Serbia who was hit, Primakov turned his airplane in the air. The foreign minister flew back, and Russia protested, but that was about it, because it was an extremely weak country run by pro-Western a puppet regime. During the Medvedev years, Russia actually voted to put sanctions on Iran and even allowed a limited operation over Libya. I mean, the terms did not allow the West to do what it did, but it said all necessary means to implement the resolution, and after that, we had the breakup of Libya. Russia woke up late. And now she literally is fighting for her survival. But she did wake up, and she was willing to fight. Other countries are not even willing to fight for their survival. And I would put in that category all of Western Europe. They don't even have the spine to try to resist. Russia does.
You debunk some popular myths about military strength, including the importance of numbers, high technology, and lots of expensive equipment. Could you talk about this in the context of the present-day Russian military? How would you characterize it?
I would say that the biggest strength of the Russian military today is that the strategy, tactics, force planning, everything that the Russian armed forces do today is commensurate with the capabilities of Russia and is limited to defense. In other words, it's the opposite of what the U.S. does. U.S. has overreached over the entire planet, has anywhere between 700 to 1,000 military bases worldwide. That's why the U.S. spends such a huge amount of money on aggression. The Russians have absolutely no desire, contrary to what the neocons say, to be an empire. They've done it. They've paid too much a price. Russia has a purely defensive posture, has a very limited power projection capability. Actually, you can see that by the Russian operation in Syria, which in terms of numbers is actually very limited. And the truth is the Russian armed forces are not organized to operate that far, sustain a military operation that far, as far as Syria. That's really the edge. Really what they're designed to do is to prevail in a belt about 500 to 1,000 kilometers out on the, across the perimeter of the Russian border, which is much more limited. It's much more defensive. So what makes them that strong is that basically they're relying on the home advantage. Geography plays a huge it's very to the Russian advantage. The fact that in order to hit the Russians, you have to get close to them is actually, in military terms, a huge advantage for Russia. So for what it does, I think it's one of the best militaries, or the best one right now in the world, because of the kind of task it is given. It could never send, an expeditionary force to Mexico or invade Uruguay or something like that. But they don't even try. That's the big thing. They use limited resources to make sure that they can achieve a very limited means. And that means is to win a war against any opponent, including the US or NATO, in defense of Russia, on the air and land and sea. And if it gets a nuclear war, it is in full parity with the United States, I would actually give an advantage to Russian nuclear forces. So that is a perfect combination, having advanced forces, very highly motivated troops that changed a lot since the Chechen years, where they couldn't even bring together a brigade. They couldn't create a single real brigade. They had to glue it together from smaller units. Now all Russian units are a high degree of readiness. They're all equipped with modern gear. By 2020, they're supposed to have 70% of only modern gear everywhere across the Russian armed forces. So they're actually doing very well. And the key thing, again, is that their objectives will never be something that is beyond what they could actually do.
What is the difference between Atlantic integration as opposed to Eurasian sovereignty? You have written that the group behind Medvedev is the Atlantic integrationists and the people behind Putin, the Eurasian sovereigntists.
Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental difference that really influences everything that happens in Russia today. So let's go back to the arrival of Putin to power. Right before him, we had the regime of Yeltsin, which was an absolute disaster, a catastrophe. The country was literally breaking apart. I think Russia could have broken actually in two parts in the late 1990s. It was an absolute apocalypse. So what happened? Two groups, very different groups, got together and said, okay, we need to do something about it. On one hand, it was big money, oil industry, gas industry, you know, all the money groups, the people. And that's Medvedev, and the people who pushed on Putin, who were the Foreign Intelligence Service, but he really represented, I would say more generally, the security services. And they did a compromise. Something like, I think, was maybe tried with Trump and Pence, which was, we put one of you guys and one of us guys up there, and they sort of will balance each other out. And it worked like that. It was pretty much, on one hand, Dmitry Medvedev was, you know, representing the pro-Western, you know, IMF type. His goal was to have Russia as an equal partner accepted by the West. I mean, he didn't apply for NATO, but I think I would not put it past him to do that or to become someone integrated in the European structures. He wanted Russia very much to become like maybe a big Poland or something like that. And the overriding, of course, you know, value of these people is money, money and economics. That's what they're in for. Putin came from a very different background. I would call him an officer. Doesn't really matter that he was a foreign intelligence officer as opposed to a military officer. He comes from what's called in Russia the force ministries, is the part of the country that, you know, the special services, intelligence community, military, etc. And his view is a dramatically different one. These people are profoundly opposed to the Western civilizational model, have no desire of Russia becoming, you know, part of the West. They know, for one thing, and know it's futile. They will never be accepted by the West. So their idea is much more to, first of all, re-sovereignize Russia. I don't think that's English, but I use that term, to make Russia fully sovereign again, which she still isn't. And secondly, to not turn Russia's back on the West, but simply stop staring with fixation towards the West. If you look at all the leaders that we discussed earlier in the show, you know, from Peter the Great to Yeltsin, all of them were constantly thinking about the West and what the West does and Europe. And some of them were pro-European, others were less pro-European, but they were still kind of, that was the big thing. The important, you know, direction was westward. The people around Putin think very differently. They see the South, they see the East, including Siberia, and they even see the North, the Arctic Circle, which they think is extremely important. So they want to decouple Russia to a certain degree from the dollar, the Western economy, the Western legal system, and basically just shift Russia away towards another civilizational model. And they also believe that the Russian values should be different from the ones that the West advocates. So it's a pragmatic, it's a cultural, and it's even a spiritual desire for a uniqueness of fully fostering a distinct, separate Russian civilizational realm. And these two groups have been fighting each other. There still are. Now, the problem for the first group, the Atlantic integrationist, is the personal, fantastic popularity of Putin, which is not at all shared by Dmitry Medvedev. He's not that popular. His garment is even less popular. So they're keeping a low profile because right now they know it's not a good time for them. But they're still here. And they're definitely the biggest threat for Putin. And they're the ones who constantly sabotage, you know, what he's trying to do. So there's this internal struggle, which is very powerful. And in last show, I compared it to the kind of struggle that we saw taking place shortly, but very strongly between, you know, the neocons and, I would say, Bannon, Flynn, who were ejected. I mean, the ejections happened less often in Russia, but they're there. I mean, the last score was... Putin scored well. He kicked out the Minister of Economics, which was particularly hated for a long while. So he's getting more and more strong, but he's far from having full control. Very far from that still.
Saker, thank you so much again.
It's a huge pleasure, and thanks to you.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over.
I've been speaking with the Saker. Today's show has been In Search of Russia. The Saker was born in a military family of white Russian refugees in Western Europe, where he lived most of his life. After completing two college degrees in the United States, he returned to Europe, where he worked as a military analyst until he lost his career due to his vocal opposition to the Western-sponsored wars in Chechnya, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. After retraining as a software engineer, he returned to the United States, where he now lives with his family. He has been blogging since 2007 as The Saker, and his essays have attracted a large audience. He is the author of The Essential Saker, From the Trenches of the Emerging Multipolar World. Visit thesaker.is. That's the S-A-K-E-R.is. IS stands for Iceland. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey! Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit snipers trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what this side yourself.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Naomi Klein's new book is about capitalism, about the climate crisis, and about fighting back. We'll hear the details from Klein herself. I hope you'll stay tuned. Naomi Klein has a new book just out. It's called This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. This week and next, we'll hear sort of her condensed version of the book, a talk she gave in Montreal, Canada, on September 16, 2014. Klein was born in Montreal, into a family that was progressive and lefty for at least a couple of generations. And Naomi is doing a bang-up job of carrying on the family tradition. She's the author of a couple of very readable and highly regarded books of socio-political economic analysis. These are No Logo from 2000 and The Shock Doctrine from 2007. And now, 2014, This Changes Everything. Incidentally, there's a long excerpt from the book in the October 6 issue of The Nation magazine. It's the cover story. Your local library should have a copy. Anyway, the gist of what she is saying in the new book is something like this. Neoliberal corporate capitalism has done great damage to the environment, great damage to national economies, and great damage especially to the lives of the 99%. There are plenty of good reasons to kill this beast, and they've been around for generations. But now, this infernal economic system is rapidly killing the whole ecosphere through catastrophic climate change. The good news is that the crisis is so severe that the people may finally decide to get off of their sofas, fight back, and make some much-needed sweeping changes. Klein says that any remotely plausible attempt to prevent climate catastrophe will have to undercut some of the four pillars of neoliberal capitalist doctrine. These pillars are privatization, deregulation, cuts to government spending, and so-called free trade agreements. All four are evil disasters, so smashing these four anti-democratic oppressive forces is a much stronger possibility now than it was, say, 10 years ago. Several people we've heard on this show also have said, with Naomi Klein, that capitalism leads to climate catastrophe. Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges and Guy McPherson, to name just three. But in this gloomy group, Klein is the real optimist. Capitalism is not going to kill us, she says. The climate crisis is going to motivate us to kill capitalism. Or if not kill it, at least give it a good kick in a painful place and knock it off its throne. Well, we'll see. Recorded live in Montreal, September 16, here is Naomi Klein.
So I start the book by confessing that I used to be a climate change denier. And when I say that, I don't mean a climate change denier like, you know, Donald Trump or the Tea Party and the people who you say, like, because winter exists, climate change must not be real. But, you know, that's hard denial. And I've hung around with those people, and I have a chapter of the book about them and how they think and why they deny climate change. But in many ways, I think that those deniers get too much attention. And frankly, I think we should sort of ignore them. We're not going to win them over. They're denying climate change because it threatens their worldview. They understand that in order to respond to climate change, it does require challenging capitalism. And therefore, it must not be real. because capitalism and belief in free markets is so central to their core that it's unthinkable to imagine that it could be true, that this economic system could be destabilizing life on Earth. So the scientists must be part of a huge conspiracy. So that's them, and we can understand them. But I'm more interested in how the rest of us deny climate change, and I include myself in this. I think we all deny climate change because it's unbearable. It's unbearable to hold the idea in our head continuously that we are part of a system, that our actions are part of a system that is waging war on life on Earth. And it's particularly hard to look because we are in a culture that is acting as if this is not happening. So on the one hand, we catch a glimpse of a news article telling us, you know, the Arctic ice is melting and ever more apocalyptic warnings from the IPCC, from climate scientists, you know, from every scientific organization in the world saying, you know, please listen. And then we turn on, you know, the television and we hear about the Energy East pipeline or Line 9 or Northern Gateway or Kinder Morgan or a new fracking frontier or drilling in the Arctic. So it isn't like our politicians are doing nothing. They are hurtling down the wrong road. So how do we reconcile these completely contradictory thoughts, these completely contradictory ideas? We start telling ourselves stories like, well, you know, it must not be that big a problem after all, or the environmentalists are dealing with it, or we must have more time, or there's going to be some techno fix that's going to bail us out at the last minute. You know, humans are very clever. This is what we do. And these are the stories we tell ourselves. Or we just tell ourselves we're focused on more immediate concerns, right? You know, we can't focus on something so far off, even though we know that climate change isn't far off. We saw the water in the subways in New York. We saw the people on their rooftops in New Orleans holding signs that said, help, we've experienced it in our own lives with more and more weird, strange weather. Maybe we tell ourselves that all we can do is change ourselves. You know, we can meditate and we can change our lifestyle and sort of turn our personal life into a piece of low-carbon performance art. But as far as engaging with the system that is taking us down that road, well, you know, that's a lot of kind of bad energy and there's no point in doing that anyway. And these are the stories we tell ourselves. And I don't want to belittle those important actions that we take as individuals, but I think if that's all we do, that is also a form of looking away, even though it may look like we're looking very hard. So the argument I'm making in the book is that we'll never be able to look all the time. It's just too hard. But we need to give it a good long look. We need to focus on those stories that we have been clicking past, choosing not to read, looking away from and saying, I just can't handle this today. We need to look and we need to absorb what 97% of climate scientists are telling us. And we need to find ways to form community with one another to actually feel the grief and the loss that comes along with that. Because it is an emotional process. You know, environmentalists, they have this model of change that is like a lot of environmentalists, okay, not all environmentalists, have been accused of generalizing. So I will say that some of the big green groups sort of have this theory of change that involves like, okay, I'm going to scare the hell out of people and then they're going to become activists, right? And that's not actually how we change. You know, we scare the hell out of people, tell them the world is ending. They actually want to curl up in a ball, especially if they're getting that news alone at home in a direct mail or on an email blast or on television. So we have to find ways to support each other in community. And being here in Montreal reminds me of growing up in the feminist movement with my mom and her friends at Studio D. You know, they would show films in our living room and cry. but you know, film was this, it was an emotional, I grew up with this idea of social change being an emotional process that we support each other through. You don't challenge people's worldview and say, see ya, hope it goes well, go become an activist. You have to stick around to pick up the pieces. So we need to acknowledge that sharing this news has emotional ramifications for people. But we need to look. And we need to look because I think that if we allow ourselves to feel the terror that comes with this news and the urgency of the timelines we are on, just how short the time is. You know, people have started calling this decade zero for climate action. We either act within the next 5 years because we're halfway through this decade, or we are locking in catastrophic climate change for generations to come. So if we absorb the urgency, it becomes clear, as Gabrielle alluded to, that only radical change has a chance of averting catastrophe in time. And that's because we've waited so long. You know, since governments started coming together to talk about climate change in the early 90s, emissions, global emissions, have gone up by 61%, right? So it's not like, you know, sometimes we talk about how we're not doing anything. It's much worse than that. If we were doing nothing, it would be static. But the issue is that our greenhouse gas emissions have been increasing year after year, and those emissions stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So there is what Michael Mann, the famed climate scientist at Penn State University, calls a procrastination penalty, which means that if we had started in 1990, as we were supposed to, then we could have reduced our emissions gradually. But because we didn't, we now have to reduce our emissions rather suddenly, by 10% a year, starting now. And the problem with that is that it is incompatible with the logic of mindless economic growth of the sort that Stephen Harper is always talking about and using as an excuse for why there can be no climate action, because he understands this. He understands that there is a fundamental conflict between that economic model and taking science seriously. Now, for someone like Stephen Harper, who is committed to defending that ideology, those set of interests that created that ideology, obviously, climate science is pretty terrifying. But if you think there's something wrong with that economic system for a whole lot of other reasons, some of which we heard tonight, because they are waging war not only on the climate system, but also on our social programs, the education system, the healthcare system, our public infrastructure, our sense of community, our health, then the fact that this is also waging war on the planet's life support systems would seem to be an extra good reason to change it. I believe that climate change presents us with a once-in-a-century opportunity to transform the global economy for the better, to turn the world right side up. It demands that we invest massively in the public sphere, because, of course, we have to protect ourselves for the weather, the heavy weather we've already locked in. And we need huge public works projects to roll out the renewable energy economy that is within our grasp. The technology is there. You know, we know that it's doable, but it takes huge public expenditure to do it, as does it take to build the public transit systems and the light rail systems that we need. So we need to invest in the public sphere. We need to invest in science education. We need to invest in science generally. It presents us with an opportunity to create huge numbers of jobs. If you take a dollar spent in the oil and gas industry and divert it into energy efficiency, renewable energy, public transit, it creates 7 to 8 times as many jobs. So it's not a choice between jobs and the environment. It's a choice between mindless growth and the environment. But there are more jobs if we take this route. It requires that we tackle some of the most persistent and institutionalized forms of injustice within our countries and between our countries, systems of racism and colonialism that have wounded our world for too long. It requires that we build a fairer world. And that is because some of the largest pools of carbon left are under the lands of some of the poorest people in the world. And unless there's justice, there will be climate change. The environmental crisis, if conceived sufficiently broadly, neither trumps nor distracts from our most pressing political and economic causes. On the contrary, it supercharges each of them with existential urgency, and it puts us on a firm and unyielding deadline. Now, as I said, I think our political elites understand this well, which is why they either deny climate change or propose false solutions, whether it's voluntary agreements between CEOs who get together at gatherings like the one that's going to be taking place in New York next week at the United Nations. The UN has called the summit, but it's clear that the leaders aren't taking this seriously. But they're saying, well, don't worry about that because we have, you know, dozens of CEOs from companies like Bank of America and Suez, a major water privatizer, that are going to come together and solve this crisis for us. In other words, rather than getting the polluters to pay for this crisis, we are turning to the polluters to solve it for us. And I think that will go about as well as bringing the banks together to regulate themselves. So they propose these false solutions precisely because they are afraid of the real solutions. And some of those false solutions increasingly are techno fixes on a global scale, sometimes called geoengineering, the idea that, you know, rather than cutting our emissions, we will spray a sulfur into the stratosphere and dim the sun and cool the planet down. And what could possibly go wrong there? But the more we fail to get at the root causes of this crisis, which is the pollution, the more these false solutions will be trumpeted and be presented as reasonable and serious. So the solution to pollution is now, it turns out, pollution. So in the book, I make the argument that the reason we have failed to rise to the challenge presented to us by climate change is not any of the usual explanations that we so often hear, like that humans are greedy, you know, that it's human nature not to want to tackle a, you know, a far-off threat, even though this threat is anything but far-off, as I said, and even though there are many precedents in history of humans coming together in the face of threats that are not immediate. Or we, you know, we're told that it's just simply too complicated for governments to come together and come up with a rule, you know, for the entire world, even though we've done it before. And we just, there was just a report about the Montreal Protocol on ozone depletion, which actually has been an incredible success. And the ozone layer is healing because of decisions made in Montreal in 1987 when governments came together and decided to phase out the substances that were causing the hole in the ozone layer. You know, and it is true that banning, you know, hairspray is easier than banning oil, right? But it's also true that as time went on, the timing for this crisis got worse. You know, that was 1987. 1988 was the year that there was the first gathering of governments to tackle emission reductions. So I would say, you know, what else was happening in 1988? Well, let's think about it. Well, the first free trade deal was being signed between Canada and the United States. The year after that, 1989, was the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Francis Fukuyama was declaring history over. So this issue landed on our laps, you know, and this was the point after which there could be no plausible deniability. This was the moment where the scientific consensus really hit the mainstream. This was the moment when Time magazine had to choose a man of the year, and they chose Planet Earth. This was our window, and yet it happened at the most triumphant moment for neoliberal orthodoxy, when this ideology was being spread around the world, when regulation became a dirty word, when austerity policies were introduced in force around the world. So what I do in the book is show in concrete ways how doing the things we must do to respond to climate change clash directly with the pillars of neoliberalism, being privatization, deregulation, cuts to government spending, or austerity, and also free trade, the logic of free trade and the signing of ever more free trade deals, of which we've just apparently signed one with China. So I'll give a few examples of how this clash plays out. I live in Toronto. Ontario had a pretty good green energy program, introduced, amazingly enough, by the Liberal government. And it had very ambitious targets. It was introduced in the midst of the economic crisis in 2009 because the auto industry was collapsing. And part of what allowed this plan to be sold, of setting very ambitious targets for phasing out coal, was that it would be an answer to the jobs crisis. And so in addition to introducing a feed-in tariff and providing incentives for renewable energy and for people to be able to benefit from basically subsidized energy, anybody who became an energy provider had to commit to a certain amount of local production. 40 to 60% of the solar panels and the wind turbines had to be made in Ontario. So it was a combination of a climate policy and a job program. And it got buy-in from the trade unions, and it was a popular policy, and it was working. It created 31,000 manufacturing jobs. We started to see manufacturers move to Ontario because this market had been created. Well, a couple years later, Japan and then the European Union took Canada to the World Trade Organization and challenged this policy on the grounds that it violated Canada's obligations under the World Trade Organization not to discriminate against foreign companies. It was unfair to Japanese and European solar and wind turbine makers to have this buy local requirement. And they won. The WTO ruled that the Ontario plan was illegal. So your trade trumped the climate, even though this was a very successful trade policy. And this has been happening again and again. The U.S. took China to the WTO. They took India to the WTO. Both China and India are threatening retaliation. So at this moment, when we should be rolling out the most ambitious renewable energy programs possible, we are instead going to the World Trade Organization and trying to knock down each other's windmills, which is kind of crazy. The other way this is happening is that when you have a success like the shale gas moratorium here in Quebec, a hard-won political success, that also is vulnerable to challenges under free trade rules. And in fact, there's a U.S.-registered company, not actually an American company, that is challenging the shale gas moratorium, Quebec's shale gas moratorium, under NAFTA, and saying that this unfairly robs it of its right to drill under the St. Lawrence. And TransCanada is making noises saying that if Obama does, in the end, nix the Keystone XL pipeline, that there could be a trade retaliation. Like, what right does the U.S. have to say no to this pipeline? And this, of course, is the fear of the Canada-China free trade deal, would be that if we do manage to stop something like the Northern Gateway Pipeline, and I believe we will stop the Northern Gateway Pipeline, then China could potentially challenge that under that free trade deal. So that's a pretty straight up clash between neoliberalism and what we need to do to address the climate crisis. The other most obvious one I alluded to earlier, which is just the basic clash between the logic of austerity, the endless cuts to the public sphere, and what we need to do in response to this crisis. And this came to a head in the UK in an interesting way during a season of terrible flooding a year ago, where David Cameron, sort of Mr. Austerity himself, was caught kind of flat-footed because he had gutted the agency that was responsible for flood defense in the UK. They had nixed hundreds of flood defense programs. More than 1,000 people had been laid off. Another 1,000 were on the chopping block. And people started to make the connection. Wait a minute. Large parts of Britain are underwater. We really need help. How smart is it at this point in history when the climate scientists are telling us we're going to see more and more events like this to be hacking away at the public services that we need most? And it was interesting because Cameron was so under siege in this moment that he very famously said that money was no object, that he would spend whatever was necessary, because he saw that there was a real political cost in that moment. You know, crisis does that. And the question is whether that could be leveraged in a moment of crisis, when there's a storm or when there's flooding, but whether the crisis of climate change more broadly could be used to challenge the austerity agenda. And I think it can, and I think it can also be used to challenge the free trade agenda. I think we should have been talking about that much more in the context of the China deal and also in the context of the European free trade deal. It cannot be illegal to protect our planet, but that is precisely what these deals are locking in. So the other thing that happened in the UK in the midst of that flooding is, so there was this call, okay, Cameron has to spend whatever it takes to save these communities that are underwater, that have lost electricity, that have lost rail access. But the Daily Mail, which is a very right-wing tabloid in the UK, launched this petition, and the petition called on the British government to divert money that was slotted for foreign aid and use it to help flood victims at home. So it was this very xenophobic response, right? Why are we helping those poor people of color in other countries when our own are underwater, right? And it got hundreds of thousands of signatures. This is the ugly side of how we respond to climate change if it is locked within this mentality of false scarcity. And in fact, we're seeing this writ large, where if we are to unlock the climate deadlock, there have to be transfers of resources, technology, of wealth from the global north to the global south, because this is a crisis that was created in the global north. We have a 200-year head start on emissions. As I said, emissions build up, and yet the effects of climate change are overwhelmingly being felt in the poorest countries. If they are going to develop, they're going to leapfrog over fossil fuels, there has to be that income redistribution. But of course, that's off the table. We're told that within the logic of endless economic crisis, we can't even talk about increasing foreign aid, let alone talking about climate justice and climate debt. So this is another way in which the logic has to be challenged.
Naomi Klein. Her new book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. I have lightly edited the recording for radio. Thanks to community radio station CKUT in Montreal for the original recording. We'll hear the rest of her talk and more next week. So, by all means, please tune in again to New World Notes. We come to you from the East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll find a free archive of our past shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimae non carborundum. Please keep in mind that an injury to one is an injury to all. And remember, you are not alone. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear whistleblower Sibel Edmonds, who has been gagged and classified by the U.S. government, share her story as a translator at the FBI and what she learned there about who's behind terrorism. And what you're about to hear comes from an April 2016 interview with the radio show host Tom Woods. It's episode 629, and you can find it at his website, tomwoods.com. I've edited parts of it here to fit into a 30-minute show. Sibel Edmonds is editor and publisher of Boiling Frogs Post. She's founder and president of the National Whistleblowers Coalition, and she's also behind a new effort at independent media called NewsBud, which you can learn more about at her website, boilingfrogspost.com. And here she is, Sibel Edmonds.
I began my work with the FBI 4 days after September 11, 2001, after the September 11 terrorist attacks, and I served two functions for the FBI's Washington field office, both as language specialist translator for three languages, but also that's Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani. But I also performed analysis because of my background, political background, and knowledge of these countries that were the targets of certain investigations or the operatives from these nations. And that would be Iran and Turkey and several countries within Central Asia and Caucasus, including Azerbaijan, because they also speak various dialects of Turkish language. They are Turkic root languages. And let me just say that I never planned working for the government. I never wanted to work for the government, not only here, but anywhere else in the world. I grew up skeptical of governments, big governments. My father was a known surgeon in Iran. He was taken in and tortured for the kinds of books he was reading and handing out to people. I went through a military coup in Turkey in 1981, implemented by NATO and the United States. And we went through all the martial laws and the curfew. So I have lived in many countries to have this pretty good, strong desire to stay away from the government. The only reason I accepted the job offer, and they basically called and begged me because they said, our country, our nation needs you, Ms. Edmonds. We have had this attack and we are still under attack. There may be more attacks. And with you, we get 3-4 languages covered, plus your background and your analytical skills. I have a bachelor's degree. I have 2 of them in criminal psychology and criminal justice. I also have a master's degree in public policy. So all those kind of were, I guess, attractive to them. And I couldn't say no, because I was just like any other Americans out there. Well, they're telling me this is my chance to serve my country, and really my country, because other countries I lived in, I was either born in them or I lived them because my parents went from one country to another country for my dad's work. They were not by choice my country. The United States, I came here in 1988. I decided, consciously made a decision to become a citizen. So this is my first and only country by country of choice. And I became a citizen by choice, not because I was born into it. So I said, sure. And I was pretty naive. I was very green. I was similar to many Americans that I get to see or hear from. I totally believe what I was given through my education in the United States, master's in public policy. I love the fact that I was living in a country with separation of powers and constitution, bill of rights, the system of checks and balances. Little I knew. I had no idea that these were illusions that were being marketed and sold to the public through the education, academics, and the mainstream media, and of course, Hollywood. So I was one of the believers. I was very green. I believed that they didn't exist only in theory, but that they, in fact, applied. Well, as soon as I started working at the FBI, I came across some major cover-ups on extremely important investigations, not by choice by the agents, but because of the higher-ups in the State Department and people within the CIA, basically hindering the investigations taken by the FBI. In addition to that, I also witnessed incredible level of waste, fraud, abuse. I mean, things that if they were to really put it out there, and it should be out there, and I'm sure many people have tried to put it out there, and it's out there, that what the government does with people's trust and the tax dollars that they are cutting and collecting every month from their paychecks. And to me, that was an eye-opener, not only the cover-ups, but how these agencies were ran. And being an outsider, I was working for them as a contractor and someone who has always believed in the free market and efficiency. My husband and I, we've been married for 25 years. We have had our own business. It was surreal, the level of intentional waste, fraud, and abuse. And with the cover-ups and issues being significant, I tried to bring some of these issues to the attention of higher-ups within the FBI. Well, that was a major mistake because the problem actually was stemming from those higher-ups, the executive-level people. And that began a chain of reaction and retaliation. And then at that point, I said, well, based on what I studied, what I have a master's degree on, there are channels I can pursue. Yeah, I didn't go out there to media and leak documents. I believe there were appropriate channels, so it's my duty to take it to the Inspector General's office and have them look into these issues and do something about it. Well, the Inspector General's office for the FBI, DOJ, they work for the same bosses. So basically, you're going to the same people and asking them to investigate themselves. But hey, they said this is one of the so-called channels. I pursued it. That brought more retaliations. In fact, half a dozen or more agents stormed our house.
Here she's asked, what sort of information had she reported?
In some cases, there were significant, important facts related to counterintelligence investigations by the FBI that were stopped from being pursued via State Department and the CIA. Because the targets of those investigations actually had other working and operative relationship with individuals within the CIA and the State Department. So whether they were notorious criminals, let's say in movement of heroin into the United States from Afghanistan via Turkey and then Belgium, NATO's headquarters, and from there directly into the United States, or terrorism activities sponsored, strategically designed here in Chicago, in the United States, and then with the players being sent to areas in Central Asia, Caucasus, Middle East to execute terror attacks. These people didn't work for Al-Qaeda. They worked together with the CIA and a certain Pentagon units. These were the issues that would not be within the scope of what the FBI agreed. And you could not investigate and do anything about really true investigation of 9/11 without linking and getting linked to players within the United States. And on top of that chain, dealing with the CIA operations and certain Pentagon, joint Pentagon NATO operations overseas that were being handled from the United States. I know it sounds complex. I have received more gag orders than any other person in the history of this country. They invoked the state secrets privilege during John Ashcroft's Justice Department twice in my case. The Justice Department retroactively classified all investigations conducted by the United States Congress in my case. And this is after the United States Congress went publicly on record and they said all my reports and allegations were confirmed by other documents and other witnesses. But the Justice Department said, okay, now they're retroactively classified, your results, the investigation results, and we impose gag order on you.
Here she's asked what the gag order prohibits her from saying.
In short, it means violating constitution and separation of powers because you can't have the executive branch, the Justice Department, issue gag order via retroactive classification on the other branch, legislative branch, the United States Congress. They basically said, you investigated, you said this, you're going to destroy all these documents, we are collecting everything in your computer. You cannot even refer to Sybel Edmonds because under state secrets privilege, which they did via court, because I also went to court in this case, tried to get the case moving in court so I could bring in witnesses and expose all these massive cover-ups and the consequences of those cover-ups, and for the public's right to know, so the information, the truth would come out. And none of these were justifiably classified. It was not about some ongoing investigations. It was not anything that in any way could have been considered classified. They didn't want the public to know because that would have caused outrage. It would have exposed government's own illegality. Well, with Congress, even though illegal, this retroactive classification and gag order, they abided by it. And from both parties, I am not allowed to discuss the fact that there has been an ongoing operation, and that involves CIA, NATO, and a certain division within Pentagon that implements, creates terror events at home and abroad, whether it's in Central Asia, whether it's by using Chechens, by training and arming them and having them blow up a building inside Russia, whether it is training and directing another group to blow up a certain entity within Turkey, that these operations are not done via what they advertise to be entities such as Al-Qaeda, or in this case, I'm sure it is what they call ISIL or ISIS. When you look at it, these entities, like in 19, my counterintelligence investigations that I was working on with three FBI agents, and these were field level agents, they were good people, these guys. The problem was from the higher ups and the State Department, the CIA. In 1997, for example, we had counterintelligence recording by tapping certain embassies, let's say if it's Turkish embassies, from 1997 records, that had Ayman al-Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda with two very well-known State Department officials, including Mark Grossman, and Prince Bandar meeting in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in an embassy, and on how to bring certain, what they call terrorist groups from Pakistan and from Saudi Arabia into Turkey, give them fake passports and funnel them into the Balkans area, and there for them to have training camps established and opening up mosques, building mosques. Okay, the financing of it partly came from the United States directly, partly from the Saudi Arabia, but also the operation included utilizing the opium grown in Afghanistan region and then processed in Turkey. Turkey is a NATO member, NATO ally country. And then from Turkey being distributed and traveling through Belgium, United Kingdom, and also in the United States. You're looking at terror activities committed by the United States government. You're looking at illegal narcotic operations being actually directed and operated by by entities within the United States government. And yet, the stories being sold to the public being that there are these boogeymen in Afghanistan and there are these boogeymen Islamists in Saudi Arabia, they are independent actors who have come up together and they are terrorists and they hate the way of life we have here in the United States. And lo and behold, they are attacking our interests around the world and in our country. It basically, everything that we had in the FBI contradicted the story being told from the government, by the government to the media, and by the media being sold to the American public. That would be the summarized version of what it involved. Well, that's why the gag orders, the state secrets privilege, in courts, they came before the judges, the Justice Department and FBI attorneys. And they said, even if she's right, she can't talk about those because everything she knows is classified at the highest level. In fact, we want you, judge, and this was Judge Reggie Walton initially, and then it went to the appellate court and to the Supreme Court, Tom. We want you to declare her birthplace, where I was born, her birth date, the languages she speaks, where she has gone to school, like university degrees, all classified. And the judge approved it. The judge said, and this is the exact sentence he said, during these terror situations, who am I as a judge to disagree with the Justice Department and the FBI if they are telling me this will bolden terror and increase our terror, the threats of terror? Therefore, I'm going to grant. For us, my attorneys and I saying, how could you declare my birth date classified? If a police pulls me aside and says you were speeding, driver's license, please. What am I going to say? I can't hand you my driver's license because it contains my birth date. It is that Kafkaesque. But the fact that these Kafkaesque authoritarian police state requests from the courts sailed through the courts. So you had in federal courts, both at the appellate, later the Supreme Court level, for the judges to agree with it and saying, okay, yes, you can do that. Heck with the First Amendment. Heck with the due process. You can do that. The fact that the Congress can abide by an illegal gag order by the executive branch, well, that happened without any resistance from Senator Grassley, Senator Leahy. There were so many congressional people that they said, okay, if you order us, we'll do it. We're not going to argue with you. That tells you that neither our Bill of Rights nor these notions of checks and balances and the separation of powers really are at work or in practice. And if you were to challenge government's own criminality, whether it's criminal operations or covering up criminal operations, or it's fraud, waste, abuse with consequences borne by the American people, then there is no power above that government. And therefore, our Constitution Bill of Rights is conditional. It will get suspended if you are exposing government wrongdoing, because government is the ultimate power.
Here she's asked if she didn't just violate the gag order.
I'm violating the gag order right and left, especially in the past 6-7 years with my book. We got a special order. It's already on the internet. Justice Department saying that they blacked out because I had to submit my manuscript for my book, Classified Woman. It's a nonfiction. So because of the contract I had signed with the FBI Justice Department, I was obligated to submit that to them. They had 1 month to review it and black out anything that was sensitive or classified. Well, they sat on it for 6 months or so, Tom, and they blacked out everything. They told my attorney every single word in that book is classified. She can't publish it. We are not going to release her from this order. She can't publish it. First of all, I went to publishers and I said, because I know I did not put anything that was justifiably classified, because I know what is classified, what is not. And second, this is against Constitution and First Amendment. The publishers, all these major publishers, they said, unless FBI gave its blessing, they were not going to publish, because then the FBI was going to go after them. So I had to hire my own team, my own editor, my own book cover designer, and the fact checker, and get this book produced and self-publish it via Amazon. And this is after the written letter forbidding me, the government forbidding me from publishing. They didn't do anything. Maybe it was this bluff, who's going to blink first? Maybe the government is so used to federal government by issuing the threat for people just backing off. They thought that was going to be the case. Maybe they thought if they were to take me to court, it was going to bring more publicity for the book and the case and the issue. We are not sure exactly the reason, but I guess they knew with the mainstream media under their control, so there won't be any publicity, any reviews of the book in anything mainstream as far as the media is concerned. It would go away. How many Americans are going to know about FBI whistleblower from 14 years ago or at the time 12 years ago? And maybe they were right. But regardless, I guess standing your ground and saying constitutionally they're wrong, you know, morally they're wrong, and I am not going to back off. And it's my right to publish it, and it's the public's right to read it. And I guess if enough Americans were to do that, whether they are government employees or whether they are just ordinary citizens, we wouldn't be in this position we are today. Unfortunately, that is not the case, because whether with the TSA abuses or with the NSA abuses or with the tortures and black sites, since really most people, they do not dare to stand up or challenge or do anything. We are seeing only the escalations of these police state practices, and things every day is getting worse.
And here she's asked that as an FBI translator, how she had access to all of this information.
Well, not only that my work involved in the FBI with these agents, one of or several important ongoing counterintelligence operations that dated back to 1996. And I performed analysis for them because they didn't have any analysts within the FBI or Justice Department who was both language specialist, knowing the language, plus having the political background of these involved nations or players, which my background did. But also after the whistleblower journey began for me. The retaliations, polygraph, confiscating my computers, the court cases. I formed my own National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and I have about close to 200 whistleblowers from the FBI and the CIA and the DIA and all these intelligence law enforcement agencies. And also, I have worked with people who later retired from the FBI on some of these issues, not only on my case, but on related cases as well. But also the political knowledge that comes with my background includes certain operations that were conducted, you know, directed by the United States, but conducted in places where I lived, including Turkey. And again, in many ways, it's different here in the United States. In a way, we are so isolated. When you are in Europe or in Middle East, you get to see many of these operations and policies actually in action. And even though in some of these, you know, all of these third world countries, everybody recognizes them as authoritarian, you know, under dictatorship. I consider, because having the experiences living in those countries, coming from living in those countries, and here for the past 28 years, that the situation of authoritarianism and police state practices is actually much worse here than it is in the worst dictatorship. And here's why. In those countries, there is no doubt in the minds of the public, okay, that they are living under dictatorship. I mean, you talked 99% of the people would tell you that they are living under authoritarian police states and that they have no rights and no democracy, all that. It's worse here because here with the illusion, you get most people, the majority still saying, yeah, things are not perfect, but we are far from being, you know, police state or fascism, etc. And that makes it that much more dangerous here because there is this denial here. There is, and as long as you have denial, you do not have any possibility, any chance for changing things, for throwing things away and building something new or any kind of standing up because there is that denial factor. In those countries, they have better chance, even though they get influenced by outside big countries, than we do here in the United States because people, they don't want to accept. They are in denial or they are just honestly naive like I used to be, saying that sure, there's some corruption here and there, but we are the best. There is no other country as free as we are. And we do have, and then we celebrate our 4th of July and we eat our hot dogs, we drink beer, we have the firework and we declare ourselves as a nation of free where the fact, where the reality is far from it. Thus, rendering us in a more precarious, dangerous situation than those third world countries with already publicly acknowledged authoritarian regimes.
And now here she's asked about how to get people to believe in what she's saying about who's actually sponsoring the terrorists.
They would say it is impossible. Again, it comes, again, thanks to the mainstream media, maybe resistance by the people to actually even delve into history and context that is not something new. Operation Gladio began right after World War II, and it is not a conspiracy theory. If you were to go and type it, it was a NATO, US, and UK-ran operation that said, okay, in order to counter the communism and Soviet Union, okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to create these false flag terror events in Turkey. And if you go to the list, these are confirmed lists. CIA's FOIA after 40 years have already put this information out. You will see these terror incidents in Italy, okay, that was conducted by the U.S. NATO forces. And then that was blamed on some communist faction in Italy or the Soviet Union. You go and look at Bulgaria and you see what happened there. You will go and see in Turkey. So these false flag operations, they're already confirmed. So what happened, Tom, is after the fall of the Soviet Union, that operation started shifting starting in 1995. And that's the counterintelligence operations I was working with the FBI agents in this specific, very contained unit within FBI's Washington field office. Around 1995, 1996, the original Operation Gladio, which I refer to Gladio A, shifted to Gladio B. Now, instead of having creating these false synthetic terror events for the long-term objectives of the powers, the Western powers, and blaming it on the communism with the Soviet Union gone, it was going to be blamed on the Islamists. And that was going to pave the way, not only our way into the Middle East, but mostly, and this is again something nobody wants to pay attention or even know about here in this country, with the main targets being Central Asia and Caucasus. Saudi Arabia oil is not going to be here in another 10, 15 years. The long-term objective has been Eurasia. It's been all these natural gas-rich, mineral-rich, oil-rich nations surrounding Russia. Whether you're looking at Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan or Azerbaijan. So, for example, let me give you a quick example to you. In 1997, because my counterintelligence unit also involved a lot of operatives and people from Turkey, Turkish being my primary main language, there was this mullah, this imam, this extremist Islamist guy named Fethullah Gulen, okay? Fethullah Gulen was preaching and wanting to bring Sharia law, and Turkey, even though they had elections, they were still, and they are still, under the military regime since the coup in 1981. So they decided to jail this guy. Mysteriously, Fethullah Gulen got into a Gulfstream jet, CIA-owned, in 1997, and he was brought into Washington, D.C., okay? And worked with the State Department and worked with the State Department's other puppet. And this is the guy they declared the United States State Department, the president in absentia of Turkestan, which is the Xinjiang region in China. So basically they said, this guy is a president. He's the Washington, D.C., but because the objectives also include Xinjiang area, and this is again Turkic faction living in that portion of China, which sits on this very important pipeline for gas and oil. And by 1998, this man, this Imam Mullah from Turkey, Fethullah Gulen, began his NGO organization under moderate Islam here in Washington, D.C. and in Pennsylvania, okay? And right now, if he's still here, okay, if you go and put Fethullah Gulen NGO organization, it will give you the value of this organization in terms of financial power at $22+ billion. He owns the largest charter school groups in the United States. Well, our operatives from the CIA and State Department, under his name, with him, they began establishing more than 350 mosques in places like Azerbaijan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Now, nobody knows where this guy is bringing his $22 billion. Nobody knows about the source of this, which goes to the heroin operation that is conducted by U.S. NATO via their proxy nation, Turkey, through Turkey. Now, those labs to process those poppies moved from Turkey to Azerbaijan. Currently, a lot of those labs are in Azerbaijan, and now they are able to do it in the source, which is Afghanistan, but they couldn't do that 15, 18 years ago. Fethullah Gulen is not a conspiracy theory. People can go. He's a Turkish mullah. He is worth $22 billion. He's the man. If they go and look at the number of mosques, by now it's about 380 plus mosques that we, together with Fethullah Gulen, we, the United States State Department and CIA, have established all over the Central Asia and Caucasus. Some of these mosques, their grounds were used for training Chechens, okay? And getting these Chechen fighters in mid-1990s into Balkan during our Balkan Wars. Some of these Chechen we used to send them into Russia to execute terror attacks. Well, some of these same Chechens now with ISIL, those same Chechens are being sent, have been sent into Syria and in Iraq. If you go and look at the roots of the Chechen terrorism, well, we did it with this mullah. We have been doing it, Mullah Fethullah Gulen, in all this region starting in mid-1990s under Operation Gladio B. And it, the documentation in terms of what this man has been doing, he's like an 82 years old man. He only went through third grade education. He's has semi-Alzheimer, okay? He's sitting in this castle in Pennsylvania. It's a major castle, and the compound is protected by all these mercenaries and with helicopter security. And this man owns and operates the largest charter school chain in the United States of America. And he is, as far as the reach is concerned in terms of building mosques and training terrorist grounds, this man is much bigger than entire operations conducted by Saudi Arabia under our guidance. But nobody will talk about that in the U.S. mainstream media, even though the facts for it is out there for everyone to see.
And again, you were just listening to FBI translator and whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds. From an April 2016 interview on the Tom Woods radio show, she has written two books, Classified Woman and Lone Gladio. Her website is boilingfrogspost.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Empire at the crossroads. Start a new nuclear arms race or invest in human and environmental needs.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no country.
I'd like to imagine no borders, no war. Well, we're going to set our sights on some of that imagination in the next segment. Joseph Gerson is a member of, he serves as the American Friends Service Committee's Disarmament Coordinator, as Director of Programs in New England, and as Director of the Peace and Economic Security Program. He plays a leading role in building collaborations among U.S., Asian, and European peace and nuclear weapons abolition movements. And our guest, Raina Braun, is co-president of the International Peace Bureau and one of the main organizers of the World Congress of the IPB for Disarmament and for Climate Justice and Peace. He is a recognized leader of the German and European peace movements and against nuclear weapons, which he has been actively involved with since 1982. And in 1983, he became executive director for Scientists for Peace and Sustainability in Germany. And since 1991, he's also worked with the International Network of Engineers and Scientists for Global Responsibility. He's author of several books, including Einstein and Peace. And I must admit, you can't see him, but he's got this incredible tie with a picture of Albert Einstein on it. And was that MC Square?
It's MC Square.
Yeah. Ah, of course. It's great. So he's visual towards the task of peace and justice and anti-nuke. And we are really honored to have Raina Braun and Joseph Gerson. And now, Empire at the Crossroads. Start a new nuclear arms race or invest in human and environmental needs? Ah, that's the question. And that's the question we're going to put to Raina Braun and Joseph Gerson. And I want to start, though, with, of course, a headline. Gee whiz, there's so many of them. Ah, we'll start with United States and allies boycott UN talks for a treaty to ban nuclear weapons.
You know, the very positive point is that we have these negotiations at the United Nations about prohibition of nuclear weapons, and that more than 130 countries of the world take part at these negotiations. And we will have a contract, a treaty. That is a very positive step. Never in history we had such negotiations, and never in history we had such big influence and impact from governments and from civil society to work on these points. You know, and it is absolutely needed because we should never forget what happened in Hiroshima. When the Hiroshima has one bomb, today we have 15,000 of the nuclear weapons. And the time can come again that we have nuclear weapons in action. And we have to do everything that this will never happen. I think this is our responsibility for the children and for the survivors of Hiroshima. We should never forget that immediately after the bomb, 300,000 people were dead. Until today, people are suffering and dying. Even in the third generation, the rate of cancer in Hiroshima and the surroundings is much higher than in every part of the world. So our responsibility is to do everything to avoid again nuclear actions and to ban nuclear weapons. And when the governments of countries like Great Britain and US say that they want not to take part at these negotiations, that is totally irresponsible. And it is really against human being and their development. And we never will understand why governments, which are connected to the life of people, will not negotiate for banning weapons which can kill the whole planet.
Just to say, last night I was talking with a young woman from Israel who's in the States, and she was talking about how being outside of Israel, she can begin to see it much more clearly, that the limitations of living within Israel aren't there. And the same applies to us here in the United States. I mean, if you go to some of these meetings, the negotiations going on now as the high-level meeting on nuclear disarmament a couple of years ago, and remarkably what you see is just how isolated the United States and the other nuclear weapons states are. The majority of people in the world understand the importance of getting rid of these weapons. You know, we're in a situation where, you know, it's like, you know, the big stick and we're not going to give it up. The reality is that in addition to the pressure we get from all these other countries, in the end, we have to do that work within the United States. Just as the women before us were talking about how they were working for women's reproductive rights, you don't get change unless you do the organizing, the education, the movement building. And one of the reasons we've been touring right around the country has been to help people understand the urgency of this and to kind of build in a new way the movements we've had in the past that have really prevailed on questions of nuclear weapons and nuclear war.
Raina, I want to push a little further. Just the UN ambassador said that this is not the right time to outlaw nuclear arms. The United States led a group of dozens of nations, actually, that boycotted talks at the Global Organization for a Treaty that would ban the weapons, and they focused on the issue of North Korea's development of nuclear weapons. And, of course, the Obama administration also had voted against convening these anti-nuclear weapons treaty conferences. So it's not just the Trump administration. So what do you say in response to them that this is not a prudent move? This is not a move that does not put the safety, for example, of the United States in jeopardy. And I see you have a smile on your face already.
You know, my first part of the answer is whenever it is the right time. And, you know, we are 70 years after the bombing. And we have now 15,000 nuclear weapons.
And on March 11th was the anniversary of Fukushima.
Yeah, and you know, we have 15,000 nuclear weapons. We have a modernization program which will cost in the next 30 years $1 trillion U.S. dollars for all the nuclear weapons country. So my easy question is to the ambassador, can you imagine a better time than now? You know, we have a world which needs a lot of money for solving the global problems, the climate problem, and we are putting all this money to the develop new nuclear weapons. My second question is, when North Korea and the United States and all the other nuclear weapons countries are not sitting together, how we can get rid of these nuclear weapons? So the first step must be to sit together. And negotiations mean to sit together at one table and develop a contract which reduces the fear of all countries, which ban the weapons in all countries. And for that, we need a huge and intensive verification project and program. But we develop such a program. We have such a program. You have not trust North Korea. You have to control North Korea. And we have to control the United States, and North Korea has not to trust the United States. So this is a given and taking. But for the first step must be to sit together at the negotiation table on who is not going to the table, who don't want to get rid of the nuclear weapons.
So Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam speech, I've been reading it pretty carefully. One of the things you see in there is the outrage that President Johnson and others were saying, don't go too fast. The time isn't right. You know, those in power always want to maintain their power and slow any change. The reality is that Ambassador Haley's statement and theatrics there, total embarrassment. I mean, the rest of the world is almost laughing at us that she did this, and it just reinforces the commitment of other countries to work for this. And then just, again, to deal with realities that most Americans are unaware of, we have to ask the question, why has North Korea developed nuclear weapons? You know, they could be spending their money on other things. The reality, and you don't have to love Kim Jong-un to try to understand why they do what they do. The reality is that, you know, you go back to the Korean War, the United States destroyed more than 90% of all the structures in North Korea. And during that war, we prepared and threatened to attack North Korea with nuclear weapons. But it didn't end then. You know, since the end of that war, the United States has prepared or threatened to attack North Korea with nuclear weapons at least 9 times. In one case, the U.S. commander in South Korea thought that nuclear attack was so and war was so inevitable, so urgent, he asked for authority to launch his weapons without having to wait for Washington. So in this circumstance, the North Koreans have taken steps to create deterrence. The reality is they have maybe the potential to have maybe 20 nuclear weapons. We have total about 7,000 in our arsenal. So I think we need to see things in their proper perspective. We always have a new Hitler, a new dragon put before us to mobilize us, so we don't ask questions about our own policy, our own systems. And as Reiner was saying, the way forward, and as the Chinese are telling us right now, the way forward is to sit down and have the hard negotiations, recognize that the North Korean government is not going to disappear overnight, which is what Obama was waiting for, and move to common security. I mean, you have peace negotiations between enemies, not between friends.
Ryan, I know that there were 2,000 scientists that also signed an open letter in enforcing the talks, and it's one of the opening statements was, we scientists bear a special responsibility for nuclear weapons since it was scientists who invented them and discovered their effects, which are even more horrific than first thought.
You never forget, you know, one of the first who was protesting against nuclear weapons was Albert Einstein. He developed and the first committee in the United States of scientists protesting against the nuclear weapons. But it is definitely true. Without scientists, we do not know how nuclear weapons were functioning. It were scientists which played the leading role in developing the first nuclear weapons. So there's a specific responsibility of scientists now to protest against these weapons, because scientists know how dangerous are these nuclear weapons. So I'm really proud of that colleagues of mine are developing this letter and are a part of these negotiations. And quite a lot of scientists are taking part of the protest actions, helping us to convince the public with the critical argument of scientists, with their knowledge, that nuclear weapons are not any longer responsible. Every physician knows what are the consequences of radioactivity, how radioactivity are destroying the environment and develop cancer for many generations. Chemists know what are the chemical consequences of the destroying of the environment and the relations to the human body. So that is the background of the engagement and scientists, and I'm proud that we have a scientific organization like PAGWASH, which got the Nobel Peace Prize, who is constantly working against nuclear weapons. This is a specific responsibility. This unites scientists and doctors, because we have also the IPPNW, which is intensive sentence. We cannot help you in a nuclear war. And this is the background that we are saying, either human being will survive and the planet, or nuclear weapons, both together on the planet, will not work in the future.
You know, one of the other things you kind of mentioned, context, and I'm just thinking now of the revving up, the saber rattling, really, which interestingly is coming from the Democratic Party in particular, opportunistically, around Russia. And there are those who certainly believe that the U.S.-NATO conflicts with Russia could trigger a World War III, if you will, and unleash nuclear weapons, among other things. I'm just interested in your thoughts and also the European peace movement, anti-nuclear movement in relationship to conventional warfare and the kind of provocations now.
You know, when we are discussing our relations to Russia, we should never forget that in 1990 we agreed that the border of NATO would be the border of Germany to the east. And now, in these 25 years, the NATO was marching to the east, not Russia to the west. So we were enlarging our area with our influence. And for the first time in history, we have now German, Russian, French, and British troops at the border to Russia. To understand what this means for Russia, we should never forget that Russia was occupied by the German fascists, 1941, and at the end, 27 million Soviet Union people died, and the area between Warsaw and Moscow was totally destroyed. There was no stone on the others. And this should never happen again. This is a common sense in the whole country. You can ask every Russian citizen, never again. And now we have these troops at the border. This is a provocation and a confrontation. And all the next steps which we are now fearing are the consequences of this march to from the west to the east. And vice versa, Russian troops, Soviet Union troops, left these areas. They left Germany. 500,000 Russian soldiers were going home in the year 1990-92, including 3,700 tanks and nuclear weapons. This was the biggest disarmament step in Europe that ever happened. So we should be very careful accusing Russia. We should look at ourselves, and then we will see what to do. And what are the consequences? The consequences could only be, you know, that we are sitting together and try to find a way for reducing these confrontations. And this means we have to take in care that Russia has legitimate political interests, like the West has legitimate political interests. And then we have to see how we can find common interests and common agreements for solving these difficult situations. And we have done this in the 70s, and this was very positive for the development of Europe. And this finally brought Gorbachev to power. And this, again, develop the disarmament process. With confrontation, we will not come any step further. We need much more cooperation in Europe, and this includes negotiations. Mm-hmm. And so also everyone has to sit together to ban the nuclear weapons.
Yeah. So just to kind of reinforce that, I mean, I think people need to be clear, you don't need to love Putin to share this analysis. I mean, Putin in many ways is a nasty guy. But to step back, and you know, the agreement that Reiner was talking about, and it was fundamental. I mean, it was one of the most important deals of the 20th century, right? And then Bill Clinton comes in and violates it. It's interesting. I was reading a excerpts from a press conference that Putin did a couple of years ago, before the whole brouhaha with our elections. And what he says is, you know, if you push a spring too tight, it's going to snap back. So, you know, the reality is under this kind of pressure, and not only the expansion, but the U.S. dominance in conventional weapon, high-tech weaponry, space weaponry, nuclear weaponry, you know, Russia, I think, is feeling in a box. And you know, they're in a situation, they're also boycotting these negotiations at the U.N., and they say, well, the reason we're boycotting is, you know, we're under threat. We have to be realistic here. We were close to nuclear war, you know, in the 80s, and it was because people like Olof Palme and people in our streets said, look, we can coexist, we can do negotiations, And it was out of that process you came with ultimately the INF Treaty and the end of the Cold War. So again, I think we need to kind of break through some of the blinders that we're constantly getting. As Reiner was saying, we need to understand the interests on the other side, recognize our government, boy, we know it's got a lot of problems. But, you know, again, pushing for negotiations that can help to ensure our security.
I'm interested in the thoughts of the European peace movement. Also, as we look at now, even the New York Times has just made some acknowledgement of the quote-unquote grim civilian toll of U.S.-led airstrikes in Mosul, which reflects a new urgency in the fight. The issue of conventional warfare, which has really become a hop, skip, and jump away from the complete devastation of populations, the drone strikes, the bunker busters, and so on. The reaction and response of the European peace movement.
You know, let me say it in one sentence. We are deeply disappointed what Obama has done by the drones. You know, all the drones attacks in the world are going about the U.S. airbase in Germany called Ramstein. It's the biggest U.S. airbase out of the United States. And because of the lips of the world, all these drones orders must get an agreement from a German signal to come to the goal. So we are deeply involved in this drones war. And you know, the drones war is a war against civilians. 80% which were killed are civilians. We have up to now about 10,000 killed people. Between 8,000 and 9,000 are civilians. And this was enlarged in the first weeks by Trump. You know, Obama was doing a drones attack all 5 days. Obama is doing 5 drones attacks in 2 days. So Trump is doing 5 drones attacks in 2 days. So we have a really enlargement. And this is really a deep concern in Europe that we don't want to have it. And yeah, we have a lot of actions around Ramstein against this. But, you know, about fear, I think we really should have fear for the right things. You know, conventional war, the NATO is spending $800 billion per year for military purposes. The budget of Russia is $54 billion. This is the same amount your president wants to have additional budget for military purposes. This is the brutal reality of the world. We have about 765 military bases of the United States and NATO, mainly around Russia and China. Russia has 5 military bases. China has 2 military bases out of the country. Now I can ask the question, who should have fear from whom? And then we are coming much nearer to the reality. But, you know, with fear you cannot work, you cannot live. We need again the understanding that we can solve the global problems of this world only together. You know, last year the United Nations decided about the Sustainable Development Goals, that we want to overcome poverty, hunger, develop clear water, develop more education, healthcare all over the world, to overcome this dividing system in the world between poor and rich. But, you know, who should pay for these Sustainable Development Goals when we are spending $1.7 trillion U.S. dollar per year for military purposes? Who should pay it? You know, there was a huge UN conference in Addis Ababa last year. All the guys were sitting together 1 week discussing how to finance the Sustainable Development Goals. Many ideas come on the table, but no solution, no agreement at the end. The easiest idea to say, let us reduce the military budget by 10% every year the next 10 years and use this money for climate and for solving the Sustainable Development Goals. It was not even not mentioned by the government. This shows that we need the peace movement, that we need much more pressure. And I'm so happy that we have at the United Nations today by these negotiations a common agreement between civil society, peace movement, and 130 governments to go for prohibition of nuclear weapons. And I hope that this is also a sign for future common actions in the direction of peace and disarmament.
Will 2017 be the year nuclear weapons are banned?
No, but it is a new sign of hope. And, you know, sign of hopes we need now, above all after the election of Trump. And for me, it is one sign of hope, like the actions in your country on January 20th and 21st were really signs of hope for all movement and all activists all around the world. And now we have to think and discuss, and we are doing this today, all the days and nights, how we can develop again a movement in the world which is near to the movement we had in the 15th of February 2003, when 50 million people were marching on the world, and really give a new impression what peace movement can do. You remember you were quoting the New York Times. The headline of the New York Times, I think on the next day or 2 days later, was "Peace Movement, the Second Superpower in the World." This was a little bit too much for honor for us, but this shows the way we have to go. And when we can go this way together with so many governments in the world as possible, this is a new sign of hope and a new sign of change. And, you know, that is what we need. We are not in the position that we are to be too optimistic, but we have a chance, and we should use the chance.
We have to run just as hard as we can just to stay in the same place or get back to where we were when there was that wonderful headline that thought that the peace and anti-nuclear movement was a contender for the real superpower, as well as it should be. And we have about 30 seconds. I just want to give you the last word.
A very short word. Be a part of the peace movement. Be active yourself. We need everyone. Without the help of the big mass of people in the world, we will not come nearer to our big game for a world without war.
Our comrade, Raina Braun, who we really thank you for your work. We're extremely honored to have a compatriot of the peace and justice movement from Europe here. And I really, that's one of the great ties I've ever seen with Albert Einstein. And Joseph Gerson, we've had you on before. We will continue because your activity for peace and justice is absolutely formidable, critical. And we all want to give our hands to struggle for the movement for peace and justice and fight like crazy until we got it. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
Knowing that the ban is a possible result of a prejudice against transgender individuals makes it hard for many of us to feel safe in our own identity.
More people have voted on marriage equality in Australia than voted for the American president or the French presidential elections.
This is not something that really has been championed or spearheaded by politicians in Australia. This is something that actually has been driven by grassroots people, and I think it's one of the great achievements of LGBTIQ people and their friends and families and supporters.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Central Asia's anti-queer purge spreads to Tajikistan, a trans teen takes on Trump's military ban, and Australian activists rally for final yes votes in marriage equality plebiscite. Those stories and more this week, because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 21st, 2017. Tajikistan has joined the list of countries in Central Asia to launch attacks on sexual minorities. The state prosecutor's office announced this week that it had compiled a list of 367 gay and lesbian people who were put on a register due to their vulnerability in society and for their safety, and to prevent the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. The prosecutor's announcement said that 319 gay men and 48 lesbians in the former Soviet Republic were identified by federal prosecutors and the Interior Ministry as a result of what they called research into the LGBT community called Purge and Morality that began last year. No research methodology was described, however. The announcement also said that people on the list would be subject to regular medical testing for STDs, although exactly what kind of testing also wasn't specified. Any transgender people on the list were not identified as such. Tajikistan decriminalized same-gender sex in 1998 after the fall of the Soviet Union, but bias and abuse are entrenched in the mostly Muslim nation of almost 9 million people. The predominantly Russian Republic of Chechnya seems to have sparked the growing global purge of LGBTQ people in April, when it began its now infamous genocidal crackdown on gay and bisexual men. Azerbaijan, another former Soviet satellite in Central Asia with a similar mostly Muslim demographic, was condemned last week by the United Nations for its recent anti-queer crackdown that has thus far netted more than 80 people. Indonesia and Egypt were also criticized by the UN for their continuing efforts to suppress LGBTQ people through routine police raids on suspected gay gatherings.
A bill that's one step away from being made law in the Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan will ban propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, a near duplicate of the notorious No Promo Homo statute in Russia that outlaws any public support for sexual and gender variant minorities. The government has already pressured the landlord of the country's only nightclub that regularly hosted LGBT people to shut it down. London, located on the outskirts of the capital city of Bishkek, had been a Saturday night tradition for LGBT people for several years. According to Labrys, one of Kyrgyzstan's leading LGBT rights groups, the increasingly hostile environment in the country has led to a threefold spike in reported anti-queer attacks. Bishkek's reputation as one of the most progressive cities in Central Asia began to evaporate in 2014 when the government launched a series of reforms aimed at reversing years of steadily increasing pro-Western values. Kyrgyzstan's No Promo Homo Bill is awaiting its third and final reading.
The Central South American country of Paraguay issued its own No Promo Homo edict this week. The Ministry of Education ordered public schools to stop using materials to teach what it called gender ideology and to instead focus on traditional values and the supremacy of the traditional family. Saying that gender is a problematic social construct, Education Minister Enrique Riera also promised to burn any books that propagate gender ideology. Somos Gay, a Paraguayan LGBTQ advocacy organization, charged that the term gender ideology was invented by conservative groups to keep justifying violence and discrimination against women and LGBTI people.
No one in Morocco seems to recognize the irony of the North African nation's human rights minister calling gay people scum. Mustafa Ramid used the insulting Arabic word asak, which translates to trash, dirt, or scum, when asked by a reporter at a conference last month about the treatment of LGBT people in his country. He stood by his remarks this week on Facebook, calling homosexuality a perversion that disgusts the public opinion. He claimed that he wasn't against homosexual people, just opposed to how they make love. Homosexual acts are a criminal offense in Morocco. The country's Association of Human Rights and the Association for the Fight Against AIDS were among several national groups to charge that Ramid's words encourage homophobia, and in a government complaint called them flagrant violations of the Moroccan Constitution, which in its preamble adopts the commitment of the Moroccan state to human rights as recognized internationally. This is not the first time Ramid has made controversial remarks about lesbians and gay men. He said during a 2015 radio interview that homosexuals should have a sex change if they want to obey the law.
But, to mix metaphors, there may finally be a light at the end of the bathroom stall in the U.S. state of North Carolina. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper announced a proposed settlement this week with the American Civil Liberties Union and their transgender plaintiffs who sued the state over the original so-called bathroom bill, HB2, and then its so-called compromise replacement, HB 142. The ersatz fix still makes it difficult for trans people to use the restroom or other sex-segregated public facilities that match their gender identity, and prohibits local jurisdictions from passing ordinances to protect their LGBT residents from discrimination. The settlement still needs to be approved by the federal judge overseeing the lawsuit. The state's well-publicized bias has cost it several million dollars in lost tourist income and prompted boycotts by entertainers, professional and collegiate sports associations, and businesses and philanthropic groups. Leaders of both chambers of the state legislature, dominated by Republicans, accused the governor of violating the agreement he reached with them that led to passage of HB 142 earlier this year. But Governor Cooper told reporters that he was anxious to put the bathroom controversy in the state's rearview mirror. He also announced an executive order prohibiting cabinet-level departments under his control, including their contractors, from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The governor's office said the order would affect 55,000 state employees and 3,000 vendors for up to $1.5 billion in contracts. "My ultimate goal," he told reporters, "is a statewide non-discrimination law with broad protections, and I will keep striving for it." Trans man Joaquin Carsano, the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, described the agreement as an important step for LGBT rights in the state. "Nothing can make up for the cruel and senseless attacks transgender people have faced in North Carolina," he said. "But I am hopeful that the court will agree to clarify the law so that we can live our lives in less fear." The state university system and legislative leaders, also defendants in the case, didn't sign the proposed consent decree and could file a legal challenge if the judge approves it.
And finally, political pundits and queer rights activists will be following the election returns this November of a U.S. state legislative race. Local campaigns generally don't attract this much national attention, but this one in the state of Virginia pits a longtime far-right Republican incumbent with a lengthy anti-queer record, including being the lead sponsor of a failed bathroom bill there, and his transgender Democratic challenger. If she succeeds in unseating Delegate Bob Marshall, Danica Rome would become the first transgender state lawmaker in U.S. history. Marshall has held his seat for 26 years. In an interview in September with a conservative talk radio show host, he insultingly referred to his 33-year-old challenger only by her first name and said that Danica clearly is out here to show that you can engage in this behavior, which clearly goes against the laws of nature and nature's God, and hold public office to make decisions on behalf of the common good. That is what is kind of at stake here, he said. Rome says her many years working as a newspaper reporter in the region have made her uniquely informed to tackle local issues. She also hasn't shied away from talking about her gender identity, saying she wants to be a role model for LGBT young people. Don Shaw, a local Democratic leader in Prince William County, which is an outlying suburb of Washington, D.C., thinks voters are ready for a change after so many years of Marshall's hardline conservative politics and blatant anti-queer bigotry. He noted that Hillary Clinton carried the district last November by a 54-40% margin over Donald Trump. The former reality show star has become such a political pariah as president that few Republican candidates are asking him to campaign locally on their behalf, or even for his simple endorsement. To quote the alleged moron-in-chief,
"It's a little bit sad."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 21st, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
We have two things to focus on at the moment. One is getting absolutely every vote for equality back in, and the other is really focusing our attention on the government.
All those fears about the sky falling, all that's going to happen is that people are going to be able to have their happiness and their love recognised.
It's the plebiscite's final push down under later in the program. But first...
Should I stay or should I go?
Fallout from the gut-wrenching move to ban trans people from the U.S. military is spreading, and queer youth from the outcasting crew are feeling it.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Nisia, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Quinn talks about President Trump's decision to ban transgender people from serving in the military. For reasons of privacy, Quinn preferred not to have his voice heard, so Outcaster Max tells the story.
On July 26, 2017, President Donald Trump announced on his Twitter account that after consulting with his generals, he decided that transgender individuals would not be allowed to serve in the military in any capacity. To back up this decision, Trump cited the tremendous costs involved in providing medical care and services for transgender people. However, a number of published studies completely debunk this claim. The RAND Corporation did a study that was commissioned by the Pentagon. It determined that the actual cost of healthcare for all of the transgender people in the military is between $2 and $8 million annually. That's just 0.13% of the military's healthcare budget. Let's put that into further perspective. The Military Times found that the military spends approximately $84 million per year on Viagra, 10 to 40 times as much as care for transgender service members. So cost isn't the real issue. It's clear that the president's decision to ban transgender people from the military is a bone he's throwing to his base, a blatant attempt to violate and disrupt the rights of transgender people in America, hidden under the guise of improving the effectiveness of the military. The military has the largest budget of any American government program by far, with well over 1 million active members. The idea that a few thousand individuals could cause such a disruption that they'd need to be banned is preposterous. I'm transgender, and I was devastated when I heard this news. It made me feel like there was something wrong with me, causing me to be incapable of protecting my own country. When I vocalized my thoughts about this to my family, they shut me down and justified Trump's decision, saying that it's because being trans is a mental illness. Since Trump announced the ban, he has received widespread criticism, including from members of his own administration. According to an article posted on newnownext.com, Senator John McCain stated, "When less than 1% of Americans are volunteering to join the military, we should welcome all those who are willing and able to serve our country." McCain supports a bipartisan bill to block the ban, along with several other members of Congress. As of now, Trump is asking the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security to study the logistics of the ban so that it can take effect in February of 2018. The Department of Defense released an interim guidance document that outlined the temporary plan until February. In it, the department stated that new transgender individuals wouldn't be admitted as they did not meet medical standards. It further stated that after March 22, 2018, no gender-confirming surgeries will be provided for service members. Current members will not be ousted for being transgender. Trans members whose time in the military ends will be allowed to re-enlist, at least until the official plan takes effect. Whether these procedures will remain as they are is uncertain. The ban is still subject to much change, because Trump stated that he could be persuaded that a change to this policy is warranted. Knowing that the ban is a possible result of a prejudice against transgender individuals makes it hard for many of us to feel safe in our own identity. Although it's clear to me that being transgender makes me no less capable than others, I still feel belittled by my own president and government.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
It's October the 21st. We're a couple of weeks away from the result.
This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay was on the scene in Sydney for his hometown's Get Out the Vote marriage equality rally, just one of the huge Yes campaign events held in major cities across Australia over the weekend. Among the 15,000 supporters there to inspire people who still have not mailed back their ballots in the non-binding, non-compulsory postal plebiscite, Barry spoke with three key activists, starting with South Australia Green Party Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
What do you think are the priorities now to win this?
Well, there are still 4 million votes that haven't been cast, but then it's going to be a battle in the parliament, and that's where a strong yes vote is really going to matter. Politicians back in Canberra Canberra. My colleagues are going to have to do the right thing. I think the yes vote will get through. We now need to make sure a bill passes the Parliament.
What things are you expecting are going to be problematic in Parliament?
Well, there is, of course, pushback already about what type of religious protections and exemptions should be included. The reality is the majority of the Parliament has already agreed to those things. Churches won't be forced to marry people that they don't want to. There's no suggestion that any of that would change. I think the No campaign are desperate to derail, but I don't think they're going to win.
Ireland was the first country to open civil marriage to same-gender couples through a popular vote, and Tiernan Brady brought what he learned in the campaign there to help lead the Yes forces in Australia.
Do we know what the percentage of ballots returned is at the moment?
Well, the current percentage returned is about 68%, which is a phenomenal response. It means we're probably on target for a 70-75% turnout, you know, which means more people have voted on marriage equality in Australia than voted for the American president or the French presidential elections. So that's a sign of how serious people are taking this and how important they realise it is. This is a vote about real people's lives and their dignity and whether the law should treat them equally. And I'm hopeful that the large turnout's a really positive sign.
Things are looking up, though, aren't they?
I think the Yes side have definitely won the argument, but we have to make sure that the result reflects that, and that's about getting the turnout as high as it possibly can go. I think the real story of this, though, is, you know, there's a million people out there who are just telling their stories, you know, standing up with great dignity, you know, and respect, and they're winning the hearts and minds of Australia, you know, and when we look back on this, hopefully we see that they were the people that changed everything.
Kat Rose of the group Community Action Against Homophobia was one of the rally organizers.
We have two things to focus on at the moment. One is getting absolutely every vote for equality back in, and the other is really focusing our attention on the government, because we know that we've won popular support in Australia. We have for a long time, and now that support has become active in a really overwhelming way. But still, there are a lot of people in government who are determined to stop equality from passing in a meaningful way. So we need to make sure that what's passed is real equality and that they don't sneak some other discriminatory laws back in some other way.
This Way Out's Barry McKay picked up those interviews at Sydney's October 21st Marriage Equality Rally. November 7th is the deadline for ballots to be received by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is conducting the postal plebiscite. The results will be announced on November 15th. Then, as several queer activists have noted, the real work will begin, maneuvering a marriage equality bill without crippling exemptions through Parliament.
Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these.
The progression and treatment of that disease is the subject of a book edited by Macquarie University professor and Sydney Pride History Group president Shirlene Robinson called Homophobia, an Australian History. She talked with our Barry McKay about the past and the plebiscite.
Australia, I think, like a lot of countries, unfortunately, does have a history of treating LGBTIQ people quite badly until quite recently. It actually wasn't until 1997 that Tasmania became the last part of Australia to decriminalise sex between men. And certainly I think for people in the 1950s and the 1960s, whether they were men who feared perhaps being arrested by the police for just their own personal behaviour, or whether it was women who had to live a life of secrecy just because of who they loved, there is unfortunately a history of people experiencing homophobia and discrimination that did continue, I think, in a lot of our history.
I asked Shirlene Robinson how the history of homophobia in this country ties in with Australia being a late bloomer when it comes to the introduction of marriage equality.
Well, Australia is a very unique country in a sense, because there is more support for marriage equality here than there has been in a lot of countries that have already passed marriage equality. So you could say that a lot of prejudices that were once unfortunately held quite strongly have been eradicated And that's not to say that there are not still people who have experienced homophobia and transphobia, but I think that we have come a long way. I think that one of the barriers in Australia has been that politicians haven't really reflected the will of the Australian people. There are some politicians who have said that they do believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, that their views are very deeply held and that they won't change those views. But we have also seen other politicians think through this issue and evolve on this particular issue. So, for example, we have a situation where actually leaders on both sides of Australian politics say that they support marriage equality. So we don't have to have a postal survey, but for reasons of internal politics, we find ourselves in this situation.
I further asked Shirlene Robinson if she thought there was any political capital in espousing homophobic views publicly, such as members of the far right of the current government are doing in the marriage equality debate.
I think that there was certainly a time in Australian history when expressing homophobic views would have brought you political capital. So, for example, I grew up in Queensland in the 1980s, and we had a premier who was known for his terrible homophobia. When HIV and AIDS came to Queensland, the way that he would talk about people who were gay or people who were living with HIV and AIDS was just absolutely appalling. But I believe now that there may be small, very small pockets of prejudice. Unfortunately, we can't say that we've eradicated racism as much as I would like to think that we have, but we have come a long way. And obviously there are still small pockets of people who may perhaps have prejudices. If you look at the movement for marriage equality, this is not something that really has been championed or spearheaded by politicians in Australia. This is something that actually has been driven by grassroots people, and I think it's one of the great achievements of LGBTIQ people and their friends and families and supporters, because they really kept this going and drove this when politicians didn't really talk about it.
So in Australia, there's a different legal framework to the United States where there's a Bill of Rights. How does that affect issues such as marriage equality?
When the Supreme Court in the United States ruled on marriage equality, they were able to draw from their constitution, which talked about individual liberties and rights. Because we don't have a Bill of Rights here, that means that really the only way to resolve marriage equality in this country is to have that vote in Parliament.
Looking at Canada and New Zealand, two other, I guess, Commonwealth countries with very similar histories to Australia, how were they able to manage marriage equality way before we were?
For Canada, it sort of it did happen quite quickly, and it's one of their proud reforms, I think, is that they do have that very proud international early history. And they had a more of a human rights framework that they were able to draw from, sort of protections that we don't have in Australia exist in Canada. New Zealand had a wonderful achievement when it ushered in marriage equality, and I think that they were really fortunate in that Louisa Wall put a bill into a hat, essentially. You know, things are drawn out at random, and that bill was drawn out of the hat, and it was able to move onto the floor of Parliament, and it was able to be passed. And in Australia, the process of getting a bill onto the floor of Parliament can be... We don't have that sort of random element to it.
In New Zealand, Christian fundamentalists were saying, you know, the world was going to fall apart and so forth. I mean, that's similar to what, you know, what we're hearing here in Australia. What sort of parallels are there on those fronts between what happened in New Zealand and in Australia?
Well, I think that you'll always have fringes, extremist fringes, and I think one of the most satisfying things about seeing marriage equality happen in New Zealand has been that you've been able to see that the overall outcome has just been that more happy same-sex couples are able to have their relationships and their love recognised, and that all those fears about the sky falling and so on just haven't come to fruition. So, of course, in Australia there will be people on the fringes who will say these things, and I'm very much hoping that we can show them that there is nothing to fear, and that all that's going to happen is that people are going to be able to have their happiness and their love recognised.
With thanks to Shirlene Robinson from Macquarie University in Sydney, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Michael LeBeau and Sarah Sweeney, produced by Steve Pride, the Outcasting Queer Youth Radio Crew, produced by Mark Sophos, and from Barry McKay. Carly Simon, Chumbawamba, and R.E.M. performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CKLU Sudbury, Ontario, Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, WHAV, Haverhill, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the midst of the Civil War, while President Lincoln waffled over the Emancipation Proclamation, slaves were already freeing themselves in a massive jubilee. The great historian W.E.B. Du Bois called it the general strike of the slaves. And today's guest argues that the self-emancipation of the slaves set in motion, or gave new life to, other liberatory struggles. In Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All, published by Verso, David Roediger looks at how the self-liberation of African-American slaves gave women, Native Americans, wage workers, and others a sense of emancipatory possibilities during what he calls the most liberating and important period in U.S. history. Roediger is professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University, and his many books include The Wages of Whiteness. David, the conventional history of the Civil War holds that slavery in the U.S. ended from on high as the slaves were freed by Lincoln. What do you think is missing from that story?
Well, I think there's always been a counter narrative to it. I think that African American historians in particular talked about emancipation from below for a very long time now. But that's what's missing, is the participation of slaves, the leadership of slaves. When the war started, Frederick Douglass very bitterly called it a war to preserve slavery on both sides in his abolitionist paper, Douglass's Monthly. And what he meant was Lincoln didn't want to free the slaves if he didn't have to, thought that the war was about union. The Confederacy clearly didn't want to free the slaves, was fighting for slavery as a way of life. So Douglass had this really bitter characterization of the war early on. But then at the same time, he had this quote where he said, this time I think we're to be freed not by the captain, but by the crew. And what he was reflecting on was that even though the kind of on high position early in the war was that the abolition of slavery immediately was impossible, Douglass knew slaves would see the war as being about their own freedom. And sure enough, within days after the start of the war, enslaved people started to find their way to Union encampments, and they'd present themselves to rank-and-file soldiers, and then the rank-and-file soldiers would have to decide what to do with them. And in enough cases, the rank-and-file white soldiers brought them to a commander, and all of a sudden, this was a problem for the war effort. So it was that motion of enslaved people toward what they thought the war was about, toward making the war about freedom, that really transforms the war from something that didn't have a moral mission to something that was about emancipation.
Well, what did that self-emancipation of the slaves look like at that time, both as it relates to the Civil War itself and on plantations and in the workplaces where these people were?
The great first historian of this process is W.E.B. Du Bois, and Du Bois called this motion of hundreds of thousands of slaves the general strike of the slaves. And when we think of general strikes, we usually think of something that's official and called, or if it's spontaneous, it's based in a labor movement. This was much more cobbled together than that, but it involved, Du Bois thought, between 500,000 and 1 million enslaved people out of 4 million who made their way to freedom in one way or another. But then Du Bois added something really important, and he said that the millions of people who stayed on the plantations also were part of the general strike insofar as they refused to do work in the same way that they had done work in the past. And often their master's sons were off at war. Their lives were disrupted in many ways, so that the old way of bossing slaves was also not there. But the idea of the experience of the general strike of the slaves is both these people who left the plantation and people who refused orders on the plantation. And in both those ways, the Confederacy was deprived of labor and was deprived of spirit, of the idea that they knew how the world worked, and a lot of masters thought their slaves were sure to be loyal, or at least professed to think that their slaves were sure to be loyal. so that there was this real crisis created by enslaved people.
Give us some stories, because your book, Seizing Freedom, does draw on historical records of accounts of the self-emancipation of slaves. Give us some examples of what this looked like on the ground, on plantations, and beyond.
Well, for example, the most courageous, wrenching decision to run was made by enslaved women, because for two reasons. One is that they often had childcare responsibilities on the plantations, and to leave without a family was hard, and to leave with a family was hard. The second reason was that commanders of the Union Army very quickly decided that they preferred to have male enslaved people come over to their side, because they could put them to work in a way that was legible to the Army. So the most dramatic stories for me are the women who steal their mistress's dress and then also steal themselves at the same time. This kind of motion out into a world where you don't know and you're exposing yourself to all sorts of dangers and really leaving a whole way of life behind. So those stories are very, very dramatic stories. The stories of Harriet Tubman rescuing slaves are very dramatic stories. The story of Robert Smalls, the South Carolina boat pilot who steals a ship in disguise, makes his way and takes advantage of the skills that he had as an enslaved boat pilot to bring not only himself to the Union Army, but the ship also to the Union Army. The songs that surrounded it were very dramatic. A song like No More Auction Block, which Dylan still sings from time to time in concert, was kind of the first history of emancipation. And slaves sort of announced all of the things that they were getting rid of: driver's lash, auction block, but also peck of corn, no more rations, no more ability to know where your next meal was coming from. So the drama is captured in a thousand little situations.
Tell us more about what happened to the slaves who then joined up with the Union Army and how that changed during the course of the Civil War.
But the original response of Lincoln and of most of the generals was to say this, to still say, this is not a war of emancipation, so you can come here all you want, but that still doesn't confer freedom on you. So the word that was used to describe these people who had fled over to the Union camp was contraband, in the same way that if you captured a pen full of Confederate pigs, they would be contraband. They would be property seized in the course of a war. And so that's all the more that slaves were, until pretty deep into the war. They were just property still, but now property in the hands of a Union commander. They were often asked to dig in battlements. My friend Andrew Zimmerman is doing a fantastic book on German radical immigrants and enslaved people as agents of emancipation in the Civil War. And he has this history of how the Mississippi River was re-engineered using formerly enslaved labor to enable Confederate blockades to be circumvented, so that there was this whole part of the war that we don't yet know very much about, in which the Confederate blockade wasn't unsuccessful because it was attacked, but it was unsuccessful because enslaved people built a channel that ships could use instead of the normal channel of the Mississippi. So there are all of these ways in which early in the war, it's the labor of the enslaved person that is critical. And then the denial of labor to the master. So both those things go together and are big, big plus for the Union Army. But as time goes on, it becomes more and more clear that the South is putting up a fight, and the biggest gain that the union can have is to emancipate the slaves and to use them as soldiers and sailors. And so in the latter part of the war, over 100,000 formerly enslaved people directly fight on the Union side.
Tell us more about the way that the slave owners and then those elites in the North, obviously with different interests, reacted to the turning of the world upside down. I mean, this sense of this whole group of people who had been oppressed, throwing off their shackles, and then the whole sense of a potential to do more. How is that received? With absolute fear?
Particularly on the part of the slaveholders. And again, it was not just that the slaveholder was losing property, but was losing a world, and use that phrase, a world turned upside down. For the slave master who had convinced himself, the slave mistress who had convinced herself that they knew their slaves, or that their slaves had an emotional attachment to them and their slaves were loyal, to then find out that their slaves had gone and had taken whatever they could take with them when they left. That was a tremendous, tremendous blow. In the North, the impact of a world being turned upside down is, I think, really interesting, because all of a sudden, the big impossibility in U.S. politics was to have immediate, uncompensated, unplanned emancipation of 4 million people. Abolitionists had sometimes called for it. They'd never gotten any traction politically in gaining support for that idea outside of the African-American community and handfuls of heroic whites. But once that happened, then people could think about all sorts of other things that might happen. And so it was a fearsome thing, yes, for elites in the North. And conservative newspapers, for example, were very, very loath to open the door to emancipation, partly because they knew that it would create desires for emancipation in the rest of the population also.
David Roediger is my guest. He's a historian and the author of Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And in fact, David, your book Seizing Freedom is really about what gets set in motion by the self-emancipation of the slaves, not just in the South. And you argue that this, what you call radiating impulses toward freedom, really transform and challenge much of American society. I wonder if you could talk about how it affected the women's movement, those striving for women's suffrage. And you write that just in the same way that the idea of immediate, uncompensated freedom of the slaves was seen as totally in the realm of what was impossible, that similarly, women's suffrage was seen in the same way.
Yes, if there were kind of the second craziest thing in antebellum politics, it would be votes for women. In 1848, which is sometimes talked about as the first women's rights convention, Seneca Falls in upstate New York, the 300 delegates there, presumably the white women most on fire about the idea of women's freedom, they almost couldn't bring themselves to pass a resolution in favor of women's suffrage. And by some accounts, Frederick Douglass had to be brought in to kind of remind American feminists at that convention that sometimes you need to demand things that are immediately on the horizon that seem impossible but that are morally right. So some progress was made in the 1850s, but it was still in the realm of the impossible that you could envision universal suffrage, even for white women.
So how did then these radiating impulses change the women's movement and reshape it? As you've mentioned, there were obviously links between some abolitionists, like the former slave Frederick Douglass, and the women's suffrage leaders preceding the Civil War. But what happened in the wake of this general strike of the slaves?
And it really is in the wake of the general strike of the slaves, not so much in the wake of just the war by itself. Early in the war, leading American feminists were so steeped in abolitionism, which was their cause as well, and a cause which in many cases gave women activists their first chance to speak in public. It was about that kind of overwhelming moral issue that and Indian displacement that white women began to claim the right to speak in the public sphere because of the overwhelming importance of the brutalities that they were addressing. So women like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, when the war started, they didn't immediately act. They took the position, much like Garibaldi took in Europe when Lincoln asked Garibaldi to bring an Italian regiment on behalf of the Union. And he said, this isn't a war about freedom. I'm not going to do it until there's emancipation. I'm not going to talk about it until there's emancipation. Well, Stanton and Anthony said the same thing, that they supported the war effort, but they weren't going to make a feminist case for the war until it became an emancipatory war. As the Emancipation Proclamation approached taking effect, they formed a group called the National Loyal Women's League, which was to support the war effort. And it actually, its symbol was a black man, apparently, in the way it's pictured, throwing off shackles. So the first organized, what the kind of proto women's suffrage feminist group in the United States actually had an enslaved person throwing off shackles as its own symbol.
You made the point that the women's movement was energized by the self-emancipation of the slaves, but just backing up for a moment, how did the Civil War itself change gender relations for white women and men?
Well, in many ways, women were thrust into occupations or managerial roles on farms and in businesses that they had never had before. They, of course, had even more responsibilities within households and where childrearing was concerned, just because there was such a wholesale movement of male labor into the army, both in the North and in the South. So the South is a very dramatic example where you have slave mistresses running plantations in many cases in ways that they would have known how to do and done sometimes, but ideologically, nobody would have acknowledged in the 1850s that a slave mistress was capable, or slave mistresses in general were capable of running the plantation. That happened in a lot of northern businesses. It happened in many, many, many northern farms. So there's that. There's this kind of change in economic roles that women north and south underwent. But then there's also this kind of emotional labor that healing labor that's taken on by women. One of the points of the book is that we know about the 600,000 or so deaths to soldiers and sailors in the Civil War. We talk less about the fact that more people were disabled than died. And I think if we thought about post-traumatic stress in a kind of a modern way and thought about what kinds of toll emotionally was taken on soldiers, that it would be many, many more people were disabled than died in the Civil War. And the responsibility for nursing and nurturing those disabled soldiers also fell greatly on women. And one of the Loyal Women's League's activities was to kind of foster that care in support of the war effort. So there's a way in which women's work expands both in traditional ways that we think about labor, wage labor. All of a sudden, all the printers are gone. So you might, in some cities, find women printers much more accepted during war than not. But also there's this whole realm of disability that was one of the really surprising things about the book for me, was that I found so much to say about the impact of disability in the wake of the war.
Tell us more about that and how, with so many white men disabled, did it shape the self-perception of whites and others?
If there were a kind of a premise for the U.S. Republic before the Civil War, it was the able-bodied, independent white man. Alone in the world, the United States decided that any such white man ought to be able to vote, that white patriarch had a role not only in owning his farm, in running his family, but also in ruling a nation. So whenever the United States talked about independence from the War for Independence forward, it was talking about this independence that was premised on ability presumed ability for white men in general to run things and to run their own lives. Now all of a sudden you had probably a million disabled white men, North and South, who were not in a position to portray themselves as those able core of the Republic citizens that had been so much what the mythos of the United States was before the war. And in many cases, they turned to their family members who were female, and it was they who were the strengths of the family. So women's suffrage grows from these great movements like national conventions and like ties with the abolitionists. It grows truly from those things, but it also grows from all these little interactions in families in which women have more power, more responsibility, more duty, more emotional labor, and make claims on the basis of having those things.
Well, I want to ask you about your argument that the self-emancipation of the slaves is the key factor in all of this that sets in motion other liberatory movements or gives them momentum that they didn't have. Is it possible to separate out the effects of the war from the impact of that self-emancipation? And I ask that because if you look at various other examples in history, sometimes you can find revolutionary upsurges following war, partly because so much is asked of people during war, and partly also because it does upend the established order. And so women's suffrage in Britain following World War I and so on, that these things are sort of turned on their heads. So how do we separate out the effects of the Civil War itself in all its dislocations and this general strike of the slaves setting in motion all sorts of other things?
I think one way we can see it is in language. Another thing that wars do along the lines that you're mentioning is that they bring together tens and hundreds of thousands of people who would have otherwise never met each other. And so the giant encampments are these incredible places of education and political education, and they're places where often, as you say, radical ideas thrive. But if we think about those camps in the Civil War example, one of the key moments in those camps was that people began in the middle of the war, the army being overwhelmingly farmers and workers. If you had $300, you could avoid the draft. So people are conscious that it's a poor man's fight, as people said at the time. They're in these camps. They have been the people who accept contrabands, African Americans fleeing toward freedom. They're learning things about race. They're sitting around in these camps. Sometimes if they have a German 1848 revolutionary commander, as in many of the Missouri cases, they're reading radical literature in German. But they sit around in these camps, and the discussion that's the most generative, I think, is they begin to say, what would emancipation be for us? And it's that language of emancipation, or sometimes the slaves called emancipation jubilee. And so do white workers have a familiarity with Bible verses about jubilee. And so there'd be these conversations in the camps about what would jubilee be for me? What would emancipation be for me? And the labor papers, such as they existed in the time, particularly in Detroit and Philadelphia, picked up on this, and they actually invited people write in and say what's your emancipation. And overwhelmingly, in the camps, it was that language of emancipation that enabled people to then say, oh, well, we labor too, and our emancipation would be an 8-hour working day. Our emancipation would be to only work 8 hours a day instead of 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. So I don't think, you know, in terms of your question, that one can prove in any kind of scientific way that it's only the emancipation of slaves that prompts this movement. But I think we can see a lot of ways in which the achievement of this impossible emancipation structures the very way that people talk about these things. Marx in the First International, and Marx was a war correspondent, wrote articles for the U.S. press about the Civil War. When the International Working People's Association, Working Men's Association, convened for the first time in London in 1864, so during the war, practically its first words are these ringing words about the emancipation of the working class has to be self-emancipation. And that language of emancipation was something that Marx wouldn't have had, or the people who wrote it wouldn't have had in 1858. It was the experience of seeing 4 million people in the process of emancipating themselves that gave the very language to the way that people were talking about these things.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with historian David Roediger about his book, Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. That's published by Verso. His other books include The Wages of Whiteness and Class, Race, and Marxism. So what did the labor movement look like in the United States prior to the Civil War, and how was it changed or affected by the self-emancipation of the slaves?
Well, labor movement meant something a little bit different than our modern association of labor just meaning trade unions, or at least until workers' centers and some of the recent developments we've tended to think in my lifetime about the labor movement consisting mostly of the trade unions. There were trade unions in the antebellum, pre-Civil War United States, and in some cities they were important, but usually just for little periods, and then they'd recede again. Or they were important in crafts where skill mattered a lot. You could kind of win things from your employer because there were only so many skilled printers available to do the work, or machinists available to do the work, blacksmiths that you knew how to do. So a weak labor movement, not a national labor movement, a kind of city-based labor movement. And then on top of that, people in unions either voluntarily or through coercion massively enter the army. So by the middle of the war, there scarcely was a labor movement. There were labor newspapers, but there was very little of a labor movement. And it's really during the war that the labor movement creates itself in its modern form. And again, it doesn't create itself specifically around trade unions. It creates itself mostly around these organizations that were called 8-hour leagues, that were kind of mass organizations of labor in any given place that fought for legislation around the 8-hour working day.
And how did this new labor movement then relate to these other movements that were exploding, the momentum of freed slaves and the women's movement in the aftermath of the Civil War?
There's a tragic story to be told, and there's a story that I think ought to be told before the tragedy. The more hopeful story is that during the war years and just after, there was such an upsurge in the labor movement and in these 8-hour leagues. And actually, the 8-hour leagues won in 5 or 6 states, at least symbolic legislation providing an 8-hour working day, which was just unheard of. If there's a third most impossible thing in life, in the middle of the 19th century in the United States that you'd only work 8 hours a day. Nobody in the world worked 8 hours a day. One little neighborhood in Australia had achieved the 8-hour working day around tremendous heat and tremendous labor shortages. But 8 hours was completely unheard of. It wasn't even a demand in most of Europe. And all of a sudden, it becomes this galvanizing mass movement. And during that motion, Du Bois insisted on this, white workers were really learning things about race, and they were not by any means perfect on racial issues, still less perfect on gender issues. But there was this tremendous opening up towards the women's movement and toward black movements, and a kind of a recognition that these three groups were all doing impossible things at the same time. So black workers are invited to the National Labor Unions, which is a white group. The National Labor Union takes shape out of all this ferment at the end of the Civil War. And it, for two conventions, has this kind of unheard of opening toward black workers. There are prominent feminists who are able to join the National Labor Union and the influence the labor movement in New York City quite greatly, especially around women's printers, that there's this effort to train women's printers and to bring them into the union. So there's a moment of great hope, and it's a long moment. It's a 2 or 3 year moment. And some working class leaders, especially if they were German Americans, especially if they were land reformers, had also been close to abolitionists, and so people weren't starting from nothing. But there was an awful lot of room for backsliding on every front. When male printers started to say, we don't want to be in competition with female printers, the official labor movement was very willing to acquiesce. When, to take another example from printing, when Frederick Douglass's son, who was a printer, tried to join the International Typographical Union, there was a lot of pushback. Ultimately, there were compromises in that particular case, but the stance of the labor movement became, well, maybe we can have separate labor movements. Maybe we don't need a united labor movement. So there was this kind of tremendous falling out among people who were who seemed to be approaching a kind of working alliance, but who all of a sudden found reasons to quarrel over what were declining resources. And they were people who were also kind of set against each other by employers.
I'd like to ask you more about that part of the story. But before we do, I wonder, since I've been asking about this story in black and white, other groups are also part of this story. Tell us about how Native Americans related to the freedom struggles of African Americans and how they fit into this story.
Well, some Native Americans were African. There were a lot of mixed race Native Americans who themselves tended to try to make their way to the Union armies, particularly in the part of the country that I'm in now, in Kansas and in Missouri, and coming from Oklahoma. So Afro-Cherokees, Afro-Creeks, people who were themselves in many cases enslaved, join with this kind of general motion of black people toward freedom. The Civil War, I mean, one of the things that was sobering to me about writing this book was how little the openings to freedom were for Native American people, how much the Union cause, for example, executes people for mildly rebelling in behalf of enforcement of treaty rights in Minnesota during the war, and there's very little outcry about that. Again, in the place where I am in Kansas, people talked about and talk about the free state of Kansas and the great battles of John Brown and others to keep slavery out of the state. the state had actually been Indian territory until the early 1850s, and so the same process that created the Free State of Kansas also accelerated settler colonialism sway in Kansas. The guns and the military knowledge and the size of the army created by the Civil War also leads to this terrible period in the later 1860s through the 1880s of the decimation of Indian populations and the fighting of anti-Indian wars. So Wendell Phillips, the great white abolitionist, writes in 1869 in an anti-slavery newspaper about protests that were going on by Native Americans against the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And the Native population realizes that once the railroad is in, the opportunity to shuttle troops around and to put down rebellions and to seize land and the development of the West is going to be so much greater that they're resisting the railroad in every way possible. And Phillips writes in solidarity with these protests, which involved in some cases destroying track, in some cases attacking workers. And he does so with the realization himself that this is very unfamiliar terrain for him, that there's not really a tradition of African-American, abolitionist, Native American solidarity. And he wishes, he's a pacifist, so he doesn't wish that the violence will attack persons, but he wishes the victory of these attacks on the railroad. And he says this is, in some ways, the most important struggle going on. And then within 2 years, Phillips is back to being kind of a traditional liberal on Indian questions. He doesn't support Indian autonomy. He said there's no movement there that he can ally with that involves support of Native rights. So he goes back to being for Indian citizenship and for certain limited reforms and kind of ignores the actual struggles that are going on in the West.
How does the self-emancipation of African Americans in the Civil War and the sort of heady emancipatory spirit following the Civil War affect the Irish and how they relate to these struggles?
Yeah, I think it's important to break out the Irish still at this point from the white population in general. The Irish are very much fighting the war. They're very involved in being drafted and in fighting the war. And a fair number of them join with Irish liberation in mind. So there are Irish militants who go into the Union Army partly because they're interested in emancipation in a lot of different realms, but also partly because they want to gain experience as fighters and as people who can fight for Irish independence. So the center of Irish nationalism in the world kind of becomes the United States for a moment. There's this abortive attempt to invade Canada on behalf of Irish nationalism in the middle of the 1860s. And so there's that at its kind of leading edge of extraordinarily politicized people who are Irish Americans and who are also often kind of more sympathetic than the rest of the population to land reform and to the right to land for emancipated slaves. But then there's also a tendency within the Irish population. The Irish population had overwhelmingly opposed abolition, had often mobbed abolitionists in the United States. In Ireland, people supported abolition, but when they got to the United States, the combination of right-wing politics and the church and a kind of hatred for what was perceived as elitism among abolitionists and fear of black labor competition combined to make Irish Americans a kind of a bulwark for white supremacy in certain ways. And so in the draft riots in 1863 in New York City, these are draft riots because they're Irish Americans rioting against the draft, but they also end in attacks on black institutions and on black people who are in the streets. And so there's a much more uneven kind of Irish response in which all kinds of new impulses toward freedom are activated, but then some kind of old habits also raise their head.
I'm speaking with David Roediger. He's professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University, and we're speaking about his book, Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. So your book traces both the rise of this emancipatory period and then its falling apart. And I want to return to that, but I wonder if you could set the stage by talking about Reconstruction following the Civil War and the backlash against it as the backdrop to fracturing coalitions.
Du Bois's Black Reconstruction has a striking line in it in which he says, if you looked back from 1876, it would be almost impossible to imagine that just 10 years earlier, Americans had believed in human freedom and equality. A rough quoting. And what he meant by that was that he didn't want to dismiss what happened in the war. He didn't want to miss this, what he called magnificent drama of people liberating themselves and then other people changing their minds about what's possible in the world and changing their minds about Black people. But then he also says 10 years later, at the end of Reconstruction, you could see that much of that had gone away. And so you see that in a zillion different ways in Reconstruction. The most dramatic and the one that's written about all the time is the seizing of political power by white elites in the South, although often in combination with Northern capitalists, so that the way that white elites, sometimes ex-planters, sometimes not, get back into power in the South is often to give away resources like timber or coal to Northern companies, or to kind of agree to be junior partners and managers in Northern enterprises in the South. So you get this motion toward political economic reconciliation between North and conservative elements in the South at the expense of Black people. And so what looks like through much of the late 1860s is going to be an experiment, a wonderful experiment in multiracial democracy involving a base of African American voters and some poor whites who are willing to vote with African Americans is smashed. And it's smashed by those big processes. It's also, frankly, just smashed by terror. There's a lot in the book about Ku Klux Klan terror, but also terror committed by groups with scores of other names that had the same project, which was to keep Black people out of politics and to keep poor whites from uniting with Black people.
So you mentioned earlier that there had been a moment, a prolonged moment, in which coming out of the Civil War, coming out of the emancipation, self-emancipation of the slaves, that there was the interlinking of the various movements and peoples, the freed people, the former slaves, women, and wage workers, and that after that period of time, those fragile coalitions started falling apart. You suggest that this isn't just an issue of historical interest, but in some sense something that we should all take to heart in looking from the present to that time. And I wanted to ask you how you understand the limitations of the unity of those people and the fragmenting of their alliances. Was it something that in some ways was very likely to happen after the energies of that period ebbed away? Could we understand it in any other ways? How should we get a handle on it? Because clearly those divisions, in many ways, never went away.
Yes. This was the biggest challenge of the book for me, of writing the book, was to think about this ebb that followed the upswelling of freedom. And at certain times, I thought, well, I just won't write about that. I'll just end on the crescendo and stop there and leave it for other people to figure out the results. I wrote the book. The book essentially is lectures that I've given and honed and researched further, and some things that I've written books about, like the Movement for a Shorter Working Day, but mostly just things that I wanted to, if I got to lecture to a labor school, I wanted to give this lecture. If I lecture to my students, I want to give this lecture. I think it's very, very, this lecture of self-emancipation and radiating freedom is a very, very important topic. But I wasn't going to write a book about it. And then when Arab Spring happened, in talking with students, I found myself predicting that there'd be new eruptions of freedom in unexpected places. And then some of the students would take the next class with me. And by the time of the next class, it wasn't just Tunisia. It was Egypt and Bahrain and then London and Spain and Occupy in the United States. And these students, I think, sort of thought I was a soothsayer. And all I was doing was trying to think about what happens when a group of people unexpectedly does an impossible thing in history, and it does inspire other people, and it's worth our knowing that. It's necessary that we know that. But the problem is that we don't then just go from strength to strength. That some of the old habits, but also old differences in the ways that people are exploited, reassert themselves. So I've become really interested in writing about the question of solidarity. The last essay in my Class, Race, and Marxism book is an essay about solidarity. And in particular, I think it's important that young people who build social movements today and old people like myself, sometimes I think we think that when unity fails, it's entirely our personal failing that made that happen. And one of the things that I tried to get at in the concluding sobering pages of this book is that there is this real structural difference in the way that some groups are treated as opposed to others, and that there's always a kind of a tendency toward solidarity, but also a tendency toward disaggregation and disunity. The best example of this concretely in the book is the very wrenching decision that people had to make about the 14th and 15th Amendments and the inability of the Republican Party to pass a 14th or 15th Amendment that would have given women's suffrage and black suffrage and equal protection for both groups explicitly. And once you got the issue posed in that way, and with the Klan marauding in the southern countryside, it was very logical from Frederick Douglass's point of view for him to say, we take what we can get. We get the vote for black men. We use that as a platform to build broader movements for suffrage in general, and we use the vote to protect people against Klan violence. It was equally logical for Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton to say, hey, you're leaving us behind. We now become the one exposed group, or as they actually put it, we and disabled people become the exposed groups who are rightless in this society. So, you know, I guess my own view is that probably people should have toughed it out on the left for winning all demands together in that instance. As it turned out, black people were only able to exercise civil rights in the area of the country where they lived for another 10 years or so after that in any case. But that's not to say that there wasn't a logic in Douglass's position, and that this wasn't just a very, very hard kind of political reality that people had come up against.
I think we'll have to have you back. So much more to discuss about that enduring question. David Roediger, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed this.
I've been speaking with the author of Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches American Studies and History at Kansas University, and his other books include The Wages of Whiteness and Our Own Time. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.